Meeting requirement, Wednesday, 22nd of January 2020. Suspension of standing order, the Honourable Deputy Commissioner.
The Speaker, I beg to move under standing order 7-3 to suspend standing order 7-1 in order to proceed with questions. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
We now proceed to answer to all questions. We commence with question number 1 of 2020. The questioner is the Honourable E.J. Davis.
Further to the answer provided to question number 150 of 2019, can the Minister of the Court update this House in respect to the facilities that still require completion of remedial work at any or newly built court facilities?
Mr. The Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sports.
Mr. Speaker, as per answer to question number 150 of 2019, works are progressing. The practical completion of the Europa Court Complex is imminent. As far as the Lastly Sports Complex is concerned, the work for the athletic track and the football pitch will start in a few weeks.
In his reply to question 150, the Minister said that the Europa Point minor work needed to be completed to the quickest over, and he added that his flatlights were ready and so on, and things were being prepared for commissioning of the football facility. Could you elaborate a bit more on what these minor works are? Because January is nearly over. And you know, we were told that we completed early in the new year.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we are still early in the year, I think, and therefore the Honourable Member can rest assured that it will be early in the year. The fact is that when I say works will be ready imminently, it will be ready. I said that it would be ready probably the end of January. We're very close to the end of January, and I would say now that I don't think it would be ready for the end of January, because there are a few things that need to be finished, the snagging and other issues that have cropped up. One of them is, I can tell the Honourable Member, that the flooring of the outside is a bit slippery, and that's what's going to be changed at the cost of the supplier of the paint that they give us, things like that, is what we might delay what it will be imminent, and also that might delay slightly the completion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just to make sure that we're right, when the Minister mentions that the flooring is slippery, I understand what you mean, but is he referring to the flooring by the spectator stands of Europa, or what's the flooring that is going to
be? Mr. Speaker, just that we realize that once it is the material that we use, and this is things that is to do with the contractor, not us. And therefore, I'm just explaining to the Honourable Member things that have cropped up which we weren't satisfied. And therefore, you should go back to the contractor and say to the contractor, look, we don't think that this material is suitable. They have admitted to it, and they're going to change it. So they're going to give them changes. That might delay a couple of weeks, not more than that.
First of all, I mean, Speaker, then if I can go to the second part of his previous answer, the one in respect of the Lastly Sports Complex. Last time we were told that the athletic track and football field will also be completed soon. I'm grateful that today he indicated that although he wanted to have Europa ready by the end of January, it might be a few weeks delay. Does he have, at least from the contractor, an estimated completion date? Because soon was said in December, but he may be in a better position now.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the situation in Latvia is that we need to coordinate with the company that actually does the finishes to the running track and the aftercare. So therefore, it's taking the time to get the right time for them to be able to put the actual finish of the quarter. The honourable member remembers the Island Games, we completed the whole of the area, and then half of the area was then dug up because we had to go underneath. So therefore, that part is the part that needs to be done. Obviously, it will take a couple of weeks because it won't be able to be done, for example, this week because of the rain or the weather. So therefore, we need to just work with the people who are doing it to make sure that they come over and they have, it won't be difficult to have just a couple of days of good weather in order to lay what is there.
And going with the German speaker, I think in the final for the supplementary, we were told in December that the swimming pool is ready and all of his left are the final touches to the platform. Have we made any progress in the second half?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, again, these are issues that have to be completed. The platform is really ready. There are also, remember, if the Honourable Member remembers that during the Island Games, we did not cover the pool. We took the decision that the pool was not going to be covered for the Island Games. And therefore, the pool, the roof, just needs a few finishing touches. I reiterate, it's just a few finishing touches before, and like I said, the pumping as well, in order to be able to complete. And remember also that during the Island Games, the changing room, we brought in for the cabin to do for the changing room, and the changing rooms are near completion as well. And so therefore, in relation to the swimming pool, where I can tell you, I remember the pump room, the finishing a few touches in the roof, and basically the changing rooms are near completion as well.
Speaker, let me ask the Minister a question. We pass by the area very often, and the nature of the pump room, I could not but notice a rather large trench towards one side of the swimming pool building, which seems to have moved down to wastage pipe. Can the Minister like to ask us to what that is for? Is that for sewage drainage of the swimming pool or some other related facility? I mean, these are very large diameter pipes while going into the ground.
No, Mr. Speaker, those pipes have nothing to do with the swimming pool. In fact, it's to do with the drainage of the whole of the complex. It is to do, remember that when you have a running track and an aftercare on top, when it rains, imagine the amount of quantity of water that will collect. So it is to do with the whole of the drainage of the whole area. So those big pipes have nothing to do with specifically the swimming pool.
Question number two, the Honourable Eagle Hill.
Can the government inform this house how many cancellations have been necessary at any of its votes of sports and leisure quality facilities? Since the answer provided to question number 152 for 2019, indicating the location, date, and reason for the cancellation.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sports.
Mr. Speaker, the only cancellation experienced by users of any of the DSLA facilities since the answer to question 152, 2019, has been at the DSLA pool complex, as reported in the local press. And the actual report of the pool is in fact, was in fact reopened on Friday the 17th of January.
Mr. Speaker, just to clear up my question for the any of the facilities or the devoted for the less authority. am I correct in assuming that those pertaining to Lucky Barrett and the Robert Falk complex fall under the category of Fort and Leisure Policy Facility, or are they referred to differently? Because I don't quite know if they are already under the control of GSLA or whatever.
No, Mr. Speaker, they are not under control of the GSLA because, as I just answered the previous question, they are still under the contractor. The contractor is still there. So therefore, the GSLA, there would not be any cancellation or anything because the allocation is going to be given. It's not under the control of the GSLA because the contractor is still there.
It's great for her to get the speak out. I understand the explanation about the pool and that it reopened on the 17th of January to which they're all glad. I remember the speaker that the deadline for notice of questioning was Monday last week. But I believe since that period and today's answer, I believe in the last few days there was the need to make some cancellations at the Victoria Stadium. I don't know whether it was a continuous sports hall or the old sports hall at that. Yesterday, I think that it may have been a result of some electrical failure, whether it was a real park or not, but I don't know, the minister has been provided with the updated details by himself, but certainly cancellations did take place.
Well, Mr. Speaker, first of all, I'm not aware of what the Honourable Member is stating, and therefore, is it hearsay and people rumouring or whatever, I have not got any information of the ones that he is getting via whatever source he's getting it from. All I can say is that when the question was asked, this is the answer, and if there's been anything prior or after the question has been asked, I wouldn't know until I pose another question in that eye, or the Honourable Member and write to me, and we can see which one he is saying, or he is saying, or whoever is saying, and we can verify it.
The President, I think I may not have explained myself properly. It is not hearsay, I'm told it is factual that there were cancellations last week in the special facility at the Bayside Sports Center complex. What is hearsay is that it could have been as a result of power failure. That is the type of hearsay. But there were cancellations last week is veridical. I don't know if the minister perhaps could say, look, I only have answers for you as of such a date, but you know, as of today, the 22nd of January, I don't think that answer is fully correct. Not because the minister is trying to refuse me, because the minister, I suppose, may not have been given updated information. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Peter, first of all, but to the Honourable Member now saying that it's not hearsay, that it's speculating whether it's happening or not happening. All I can say is that the Honourable Member tells me the question. I go back to the official, I get the answer, and this is the answer I get. Now, if things happen in between, I can tell the Honourable Member, if he wants to either pose the question next month, or whenever it's question time, I will answer the question. If not, I am asking the Honourable Member to write to me or to phone me an email, and I will verify that from the day that the question was answered to this precise moment, I can give him whatever the information there is, if there is any.
I'm happy with that.
I know the Minister has given me a chance of being able to contact him, and he will be able to see it on that avenue.
Question number 3, the Honourable E.J. Hill.
Further to the answer provided to question number 153 of 2019, can the Minister for Sport provide a breakdown of details of users in respect of the £6,565 fees paid by the users of facilities falling under the auspices of the Board of Sport and Leisure Policy for community use in the financial year 2018-2019, together with details of any payments still pending to be received.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 4 to 6.
Question number four, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Where that will answer the resident question number 153 of 2019. Can the Minister for Sport provide a breakdown of details of users in respect of the £15,000 fee paid by users of facilities falling under the expectations of the Board of Sports and Leisure Policy for advertising during the financial year 2018-2019, together with details of any payments still pending to be received?
Question number five, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Further to the answer to Resident Question number 153 of 2019, can the Minister for Sport provide a breakdown of details of users in respect of the £17,911 fee paid by the users for facilities falling under the auspices of the Board of Sports and Leisure Policy for sporting events during the financial year 2018-2019, together with details of any payments still pending to be received?
Question number six, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Further to the answer provided to question number 153 of 2019. Can the Minister for Sport provide a breakdown of details of users in respect of the £14,522.34 fees paid by users or facilities falling under the auspices of the Board of Sport and Leisure Policy for non-sporting events during the financial year 2018-2019, together with details of any payments still pending to be received?
I to the Honourable Minister for Health, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand over the Honourable Member opposite the breakdown of the information requested.
Question number seven, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, further to the answer provided to question number 154 of 2019, can the Minister for Sport provide a breakdown of the details of users in respect of the £107,523.50 fee paid by users of facilities falling under the auspices of the Board of Sports and Leisure Authority for sporting events during the financial year 2017-2018? Together with details of any payment still pending to be received?
I am the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer these questions together with question 8 to 10.
Question number 8, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Further to the answer provided to question number 154 of 2019, can the Minister for Sport provide a breakdown of the details of users in respect of the £11,954.41 fee paid by users of facilities falling under the auspices of the Board of Sport and Leisure Authority for non-sporting events during the financial year 2017-2018, together with details of any payments still pending to be received?
Question number 9, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Further to the answer provided to question number 154 of 2019, can the Minister for Sport provide a breakdown with details of users in respect of the £15,000 fees paid by users of facilities falling under the auspices of the Board of Sport and Leisure Authority for advertising in the financial year 2017-2018? Together with details of any payments still pending to be recovered?
Question number 10, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Further to the answer provided to question number 154 of 2019, can the Minister for Sport provide a breakdown with details of users in respect of the £10,994 fees paid by users or facilities falling under the auspices of the Board of Sport and Leisure Authority for community use during the financial year 2017-2018, together with details of any payments still pending to be received?
I am the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sport.
Mr. speaker, I now hand over the Honourable Member opposite with a breakdown in information requested.
Mr. Speaker, while that travels across the floor, as it were, can I ask the Honourable Member, the Honourable Minister, to come back to the schedule he handed to us in respect of questions 26, and if I may, can I just ask a couple of supplementaries in relation to that? In respect of the non-sporting event, there is a breakdown there of the number of entities that paid fees. Can the Minister perhaps illuminate us a bit about the nature of those events? I know what they've been confused is because I think my daughter's attended that kind of thing. But in respect of the others, what kind of events were they?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I don't know specifically which events exactly they were, but I can tell him that the first and training tend to do quite a lot of events around Gibraltar, and they are could have been the electric festival, electronic festival, one of those festivals. Project X, similar and redefined the same. And these are events that have taken place within the Victoria Stadium, either in the Muga area outside, or they take place in the Serpentinary, or have taken place not for very long anymore, but in the sports court. So it's within the Victoria Stadium, and these are smaller events, bigger events, and these are the companies that actually do the events, and they have to pay a fee for that.
Thank you for that. And can the Minister help us a bit as to the basis on which these things are calculated? Why are there differences? So if you organise an event, for example, on a particular day, why do you get a flat fee? What's the difference between the two?
Well, Mr. Speaker, there can't be a flat fee because it depends on how big the event is, and therefore it depends on how much, how many days they need. For example, the Serpentinary Hall, if you're doing the dark, for example, they take 2 or 3 days to set up, and it's calculated to do with the set fee, for example, on deposit. But there are not set fees in the overtime, which some of our workers in the DSLA have to work for. Some need, they finish late, for example, they don't finish at 11 o'clock, which is the time that the workers at the Victoria Stadium or within the complex work, and they have to say 2 to 3 o'clock in the morning. So it's all calculated depending on how much it costs us. And then we pass the charge to the company that is actually doing the event.
So when the Honourable Member says how much it costs us, i.e. GSLA, you mean that inputs into that fee, you're passing on staffing costs and things like that?
Absolutely, and we've introduced that because what was happening was previously is that you get a company coming to the Victoria Stadium, doing an event, as in the DSLA, paying for damages, overtime, electricity, water, wear and tear of equipment, and we were paying for all that. And the event organizer used to get their profit, and off they went. So what we have done is we have introduced a fee which includes all these things, and it depends on how long they take in the event for their charge, and that's why there are differences of fees.
And can the Minister then confirm, apart from these sort of running costs that you're passing on, over and above that, there's also a fee, or is it just the running costs that you're passing on? And then finally, on that schedule, the RBSI advertising, is that a cost sort of receipt for the respective Highland Games? Or is it something else?
So, can you repeat the question?
The RBSI advertising revenue, what's that in relation to? Is really that what I want to know? Is it Highland Games or is it something else? But because my honourable colleague, Mr. Seymour, points out that there's a similar amount in 2017-18, so it can't, presumably, it's not a sort of Highland Games amount.
No, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Chief Minister reminded me it's to do with the summer sports development. The summer program that we run, which is also sponsored by NatWest. So, they do a fantastic work for us as in giving us a sponsorship for NatWest.
If I may ask the Minister, somehow I've noticed in the schedule he provided in answer to question 3 to 6 for 2018-19, there are two particular items that have misallocation of funds, which the two men payments for a total about £2,795 exactly. And can the Minister give a half explanation as to how revenue receipts can be described as misallocation?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the notes that the director has given me as a supplementary to the new office, obviously, is that the misallocation of funds was the result of a payment credited to an erroneous subset. So it's directed somewhere else, and then obviously wasn't supposed to have gone there and was redirected. That's the answer that I've got.
I'm so grateful for the minister's answer. Were we actually told what they were meant to be in respect of originally?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Now, Mr. Speaker, just to clarify for me, the minister in both schedules gives the £15,000 revenue from advertising, which I compare with the minutes, I think it's the advert that are put around the all the facilities at the Dayside complex in the summer sports program and so on. Yet, in respect to the financial year 2017-18, at the very bottom of the page, he does it, I think, relates to basketball, has advertising brackets, which is for advertising. Should not the federal government want that better to come under an advertising heading rather than, you know, it's nice to see from sporting events. I don't quite know why an advertising item is not under advertising.
I think this was the tournaments that were done by FIBA, and they had their own. I think they had their own advertising. They came with their own advertising, but obviously, if they come with their own advertising, they should pay the DSLA a fee or a piece of time, because it seems like a very wrong figure. And that's what I think it is. It's just that when associations do. And they get their own sponsorship. They're supposed to be paying the first saving sum of that sponsorship. So, but I will try and find out exactly, because I don't want to miss this point, but try and find out exactly what this FIBA means. If I recollect, I think it was a tournament that FIBA did themselves.
I'm grateful and content, Mr. Speaker, that the Minister will try to find out and then we'll meet him again before. If he grants reports to the House, it means he goes in hand for whatever someone has to do with the reference. Thank you.
Question number 11, the Honourable E.J. Hillary.
can the Minister for Sport provide details of any financial arrangements currently in place, whereby the Board of Sports and Leisure Authorities staff carry out maintenance and other work for the now Gibraltar Football Association owned facilities at Victoria Stadium?
And for the Honourable Minister for Hybrid, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, at present, there is no financial arrangement in place whereby the GSA will carry out maintenance for the Gibraltar Football Association within the development area of the Victoria Stadium. Staff continues to work as normal, carrying out the day-to-day tasks, including maintenance in the development area, as well as all other areas.
Mr. Speaker, is the GSA staff carry out duties in facilities that are now owned by the Gibraltar Football Association? Does that mean that that staff has been like the conduit to the Football Association and answerable to the managerial team, or how quite does it work? And why, it raises a fair question, you know, why does this association receive actual staff support, whereas other associations, as I said before, may have to take the support in place of stock.
You see, I don't see which other association actually charge any cost. Anyway, going back to his original question, what we're doing is working very closely with the GSA, and yes, then the GSA employees are under the GSA management, and it is that they manage the Victoria Stadium as they have always done, and that is why I put here carrying out day-to-day tasks involving maintenance in the development area as well as in other areas. We are continuing as if it was the property of the government, because we are in working with the GSA in order for them, once the area is started to develop, up to now there's no development really, there's nothing happening. Until they start, that is when we are working with the GSA to see what regime we will put in place in order. Because the GSLA will probably have last week to run. So that is when it becomes a little bit of a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps I better wait till the last review and go there. Just one thing arises here. In previous questions, if you allow me, Mr. Speaker, the Minister made reference to an MOU that the GSLA has entered into with the GSA. And when we asked, could we sort of have access to the content of that, he said we would need to talk to the GSA first to see whether that could be handed over or not. Has the Minister had an opportunity perhaps to see if we can have a site of those MOUs?
No, not yet. And the reason being is that there are some of the parts of the MOU are being amended by both sides. So although we haven't quite actually had it signed, sealed and delivered, we're still on a work in progress. But I can tell the Honourable Member that for us on our side, there's no issue as to the final MOU that we will work with the GSA. I'm sure there are many things that we need to work with the GSA, especially when they take over what is part of their land in relation to what is the government plan. Things like access and roads getting in and out and these are the sort of things we're working
on. Can the Minister also confirm whether the MOU spans the interim arrangements that he's been discussing now in respect of maintenance, the answer to my own member and your colleague's question, and future arrangements, or is the MOU
Mr. Speaker, I could say that the MOU is basically the transition period, because ultimately what will happen is that the GSA will have its stadium where they will have to run it themselves, and we will have our part to do maintenance and all that. So it's basically the transition period. It's a question of the GSA trying to get run, obviously, the National Stadium, which they will be running. So basically, this MOU was all the construction work and all the moving about of one to the better where it's happening.
And so, is that the case? Is the government in some kind of parallel discussions with the DSA in respect of the terms of the transfer, for example, by this very specific question, is the government introducing any terms in respect of the transfer of that stadium to allow use of the facility from time to time by other entities, or is it going to be up to the DSA to determine use from the guest?
I think it would be where we could come into agreement with the DSA to see how we can use their facilities. Remember that they're going to use our facilities. So there has to be a quid pro quo as to who uses what, and obviously it will become, the stadium will become a football stadium. And sure, within that limit, there can be the complex. It's not only a football stadium, there are other amenities around it, and that the general public is probably using. So we're working on that because it's how we get the final sort of separation or final, although separate, that we can both share all our amenities.
Would I be right to conclude from that answer that those divisions are still sort of live and under discussion between the government and the DSA?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
One final thing that I may, Mr. Speaker. We were previously talking about the facility that Luxury and Europa, for which the Minister said to you that we were hopeful for quite soon completion of sports, sorry, football related facilities. Would those remain exclusive to TSLA and therefore form part of the MOU so that the TSA can use the facilities, or are they going to be handed over to the Football Association and therefore form part of an agreement by an MOU?
No, Mr. Speaker, lastly, as I said, it would be like the old Victoria Stadium. It won't be, you know, the TSLA will run as if it was the old Victoria Stadium. The system of the lab, athletics will be played there, the children in school can use it, the whole of the community can use
it. Question.
Question number 12, the Honourable Edo Hayes.
Can government provide the date by which the children's play park in between St. John's and Notre Dame schools of Laguna State will be open for public use, together with details of opening times and indicating under whose responsibility will the day-to-day maintenance of these facilities come under?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the new adventure playground and ball playing area will be ready for the contractor to hand over within the next 6 weeks, after which there will be a very brief snagging period. The facility will be added to the list of playgrounds currently under the DSLA remit, with opening times in line with other similar playgrounds.
Question number 14, the Honourable AJ Hayes.
Further to the answer provided to question number 156 of 2019, can the Minister for Housing update this House with details of new arrangements made with the idea of implementing the same modern facilities as other people's house, as already enjoyed by the tenants of the other rental homes provided by governments exclusively for senior citizens?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the answer remains the same as my answer to question 156, 2019.
And Mr. Speaker, is the Minister find it machine to sort of enter into some sort of arrangement.
Is the minister aiming for a particular date for when we hope to have come to a satisfactory arrangement with the residents of the British House and the community?
Mr. Speaker, and a very honourable member was not present to the debate last week, last month, but we did bring up all these issues. And yes, as soon as this is ready, it will be implemented. So it's not ready yet, it will be.
Question number 14, Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Further to the answers provided to questions numbers 161 and 162 for 2019, can the Minister for Housing provide details of the final outcome of a case of unlawful occupation which the Housing Department is receiving?
I will put the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sports.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this together with question 15.
Question number 15, Robert E. Davis.
Can government inform this House how many cases of unlawful occupation of government rental homes are currently being investigated by the relevant authorities?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sports.
Mr. Speaker, the answer remains the same as my answer provided in respect of question 162 of 2019.
Okay, Mr. Speaker, so I hope I understood. What remains the same in answer to question number 162 was that there was still no final outcome. We were still looking into working in respect of an unlawful occupation. But then my number question number 15 now says, you know, how many are currently being dealt with. Can the minister be clarified? There's been no new one and it's just the same one as sending. I'm not entirely clear when I refer back to answers next month or whatever next session. I'm confused and then I pose it all these questions, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, the answer was last time that one case of unlawful occupation which the Housing Department is dealing with. We are still dealing with that one, and the rest of the answer is exactly the same.
Question number 16, Noble E.J. Hayes.
Can anyone provide an update in respect of this affordable housing project just to understand continually territory, indicating the number of homes sold, number of homes still to be sold, and its estimated construction date?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, it is very difficult to provide an exact figure as to how many flats have been allocated at Hassan Centenary Territory, as sales are taking place daily. Well over 500 flats have now been allocated. The contractor has taken possession of the site, and construction will begin shortly. A contractor program needs to be finalized, but it is anticipated that the project will take 39 months to complete.
Speaker, can the Minister and official who can't get into the scientific commencement date, but doesn't have a bit more than 40. There's not an anticipated not commencement date for the construction. I mean, I'm not going to hold him to it, but at least it.
Mr. Speaker, as I understand it, the site is already ready.
contractors are already moving in as we speak. And therefore, when I say soon, it's, I can really have said now, but it's going on now because I don't know whether it's a public knowledge that there are two phases, and phase one is already on the way.
I think that my question was the number of homes that have already been sold, and the Minister of Rent is saying that over 500 have been allocated. I don't want to go into legal technical terms of what the difference is. You know, 500 sort of have 500 homes have an element to it, and perhaps at a particular different legal stages where one calls them homes or allocated. I even take it as perhaps, you know, when initial deposits have been made and certain installments are forthcoming. But I carried on my question by saying the number of homes still to be sold. I know the Minister was carefully saying that, you know, the numbers are changing daily, but he was able to round off a figure which I set around 500. So will you be able to round off a figure of how many sort of homes are still available for grads who want to use that word?
I do hate to lay the point, but one does feel that as if we've been here for an hour having what might have been termed almost a fire-fight chat with each other, because we'd like to agree with another gentleman, but there are 665 homes available at just one of the Union Territories. The noble gentleman has told us there are 500, which is simply mathematics. 165. So, I was wondering, ask the Minister, you mentioned two phases, phase one and phase two. Could you elaborate as to what phase one is? Is this to do with clearance of the mound on the site?
Yeah.
Or is it that the site is actually level and ready for construction? Of course, it is a point that you're going for.
Well, yes, Mr. Speaker, it's because the Honourable Member hasn't taken time to read our press releases and has not done his homework. I say him as a teacher. It's out in the public domain. Everybody knows about the Hassan Centenary Terrace. How it's going to be built. How many houses there are. But to come to this house and ask me that question, it's public knowledge. It's public knowledge. I am not here to do the Honourable Member's work. I am here to answer questions of things that he wants to ascertain from government that the public don't know. That the Honourable Member can do is come here, ask me, what is the price of this number that you brought out this?
Mr. Speaker, it's getting beyond the ridiculous.
Question number 17, the Honourable Mr. M.D. Hassan.
Thank you, what a welcome, Mr. Speaker. I wish it was like that every time I read. Following from last week's revelation in the press that 150 units are still available or unsold in Hassan Centenary Terraces, what reasons does the government attribute to such a glut in this development?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Housing, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, there is no glass, as the Honourable Member is repeating from the statement in the press. The allocation process is still ongoing. There are a total of 665 flats to be allocated in the development, of which the Board of Residential Properties Limited has received over 2,400 applications. Of these applications, nearly 900 have received at least one. There are many more applicants yet to be seen than there are remaining flats. Government is confident that all the flats will be allocated and there will still be even more people wanting to buy flats at first, the new and second view.
question to Speaker. I really didn't mean the defensive response from the Honourable Member. I was trying to respect him. Very popular today, Mr. Speaker. He's very popular today, Mr. Speaker, from all sides of the House. Now, I recently understood that the government or the housing department offered an upgrade in size to people who technically only had the need for smaller units, and I was wondering whether perhaps this had anything to do, or this is following on from the possibility that the government wasn't filling up the demand for houses. Could it be that the purchase terms are causing obstacles to potential purchases, and that's why it hasn't been filled? Because yes, the Honourable Member says that there is more left to sell, but by now there had been a lot of talk about so much oversubscription, and yet we understand that at this point not all of them had been sold. So I'm wondering whether perhaps bridge loan issue has been an issue or anything of the sort that has contributed to this 150 odd that haven't been sold.
Thank you, Peter. The Honourable Lady must understand that people are not even thinking of being a defensive at all, for the start of it. Just to put the Honourable Lady right, there are 655 houses to be sold. People show an interest, of which there were 2,400 people interested in buying. Therefore, if there are 655 houses, and 2,400 interested people, of course there are going to be people who have to wait. And of course there are going to be people who won't be able to buy because there's a higher demand than there is the supply. Therefore, what we did was we actually did upgrade, and that is why the movement, and I said it was aligned, I said it at the very beginning, it's flexible. If somebody has a house now, and it is upgraded, then that house has to be sold. And what you do is you go over the list. 900 people have been seen at least once in order to call them in to see which house they prefer. So we are working through the whole list, and it will take time. But I can guarantee the Honourable Lady that what happens is that other people also are waiting for the other to receive. So this is the issue. The issue is that exactly just for the mathematics. So that's why I say there's more demand than there is for this estate. But there are two more estates coming through. So these are the issues that are on a daily basis. And that's why I wouldn't even dare to say how many houses exactly we have sold. I cannot. Now they're probably selling a few. So I would be misleading the Parliament if I gave exact figures.
Thank you for that answer. Mr. Speaker, so why would, if the Honourable Gentleman might be able to indulge me, why would we think that the press would pick up on the fact that there are 150 houses or units left to sell if it's a perfectly normal path of the way that that these projects seem to develop? Why was it flagged up?
Because the issue of the press is, for that simple reason. Because we wanted to update the community that was happening, because we received daily requests for information of people who wanted to buy and want to know why they haven't yet been called. And the numbers that the member was giving are important ones, because look, if you've got 2,400 applicants for 665 properties, the problem that you have is not that you have a glut of properties, it's that you have a glut of applicants. And so, Mr. Speaker, the important number for her to go away with is that the 165 left will have to be all that's available for the 1,500 that haven't yet been called. Of the 900 that were called, 500 have bought these particular properties. So I think we are in a very good position. This estate has seen remarkable acceptance. It is one that people are really wanting to buy into because of the price, because of the terms and conditions, which are extraordinarily generous, and indeed because of the location, which is a very favourable one. And I remind all of the members that was seen as an area only for luxury development. What others
suggested to be for the luxury market, we have made available for Gibraltarians on the housing waiting list who are eligible to buy. That, Mr. Speaker, is the approach that we're taking, and that is the sort of reality that underlies the housing policy, which determines how we're going to continue. Great sites like the Eastside Development, like the area on Queensway where we're going to develop Chatham View, like the area of the port we're going to develop Bob Felicia Terraces or News or whatever it is that it's called. All of these are excellent opportunities for young Gibraltarians eligible to buy to get their foot in the housing ladder. We probably have huge acceptance and we're very proud of the way we're today. And I'd like to thank, Mr. Speaker, the people at the GRPL who are responsible for this work, because the diligence with which they do this work, if they realize that somebody's in the start, they call them back in. If they think somebody's not made, they have the opportunity of having the best choice put to them because they've had somebody else considering a home, they call them back in and say, look, you considered three homes, but somebody else is going for another one, you should consider this one also. This level of diligence is something which the government finds absolutely commendable, and I thank the men and women of the RPL for the work that they're doing.
Question number 18, the Honourable Chief of Society, on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, we're in danger because Mr. Phillips is flying back because of the bad weather and he suffered a bit of a delay. So I think his question is why he arrived. Mr. Speaker, further to question 171, 2019, how many patients have been waiting over 12 weeks for hearing?
I will be able to Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, currently 39 patients have been waiting over 12 weeks for hearing aid. Mr. Speaker, in respect of these patients, is there any sort of obvious explanation of why this number of patients that have to wait? Because my understanding is that the 39 patients, at least most of them, have been waiting for 12 weeks, still have a clinical stage where the hearing aid has to be ordered, and then, of course, that will impair the delay, whatever delivery date is, with the prior intake report. So, you know, does the minister have any further information of why it seems to be this fact level for 39 as opposed to the average waiting time of 12 weeks?
Mr. Speaker, the question of the Honourable Gentleman was asking was entirely applied to quite comprehensively last month. And what we explained, what I explained last month, is a very good process which we culminate in a person receiving a hearing aid. And as part of that process, there are several appointments whereby patients are asked whether we work best with them, whether they are internal seeking devices or external seeking devices. Some are going to be straightforward, simple, and in fact can be given off the shelf. And that reduces the waiting time considerably. But there are other patients who request a hearing aid with the internal device, and that needs to be produced specifically and taken into consideration the context of the inner ear. So there are a number of reasons why there can be people have to wait more time than I would have. Last month we did explain it, and if you look at the handset, you can be careful what you say then.
I did look at it for that, but if the number of patients that have been waiting over 12 weeks to get to be called in to see what hearing aid the one they're going to choose, to see if it's the one available on the shelf, to see if it's one that has to be ordered. But the 12 weeks have elapsed and they're still waiting and not even have an indication of the date or when they are due. They already have all the hearing tests needed, they already have more than one appointment to follow up. They are now, from what they tell me, they are now like in a state of limbo, waiting to see what's going to happen. And there was a surprise that the answer was they were given us 1 week. The 12 weeks had elapsed for them, and I heard nothing further. That is what I was trying to ask the minister. You know, why that delay? Why that delay? This is nothing to do with the time the unit may need to come to the UK. One of the officers is not suitable for that individual.
You see that the delay is in certain patients
in fact, some patients are even fast-tracked, especially those who severe hearing loss and allergy. So there is a prioritization involved. But the delay is something which obviously was raised last month, and I am taking interest to see more where things can be done to make this even further, because we really want our best interest always to make these wait less for things, and that is what our aim is. And I think we are looking into it. But there is a process whereby a patient is referred to a patient with a GP, then it's referred as a further sent to the audiologist. The patient is then seen in case of hearing later, and then there is a process, there is some waiting time, because of not only the amount of new requests that are coming through and the first coming through, but also there are numerous hearing aid devices which are lost, there's four, there's frozen on, they're damaged. And this adds to the requirement. Once the hearing aid, once a doctor sees the patient, then as I said, it can be a very quick process, but it's instantaneous. By that time, the hearing test is carried out, and nobody can ask me, and they can just hand them a hearing aid off the shelf. If not, then there can be a wait of 3 to 4 weeks after that to receive. On the device, so it is the time that they take.
Next question.
Question number 19. The Honourable Chair of the Parliament on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, can the government state the criteria for the application of the Gibraltar Health Authority's health card?
And for the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, the criteria in respect of applications for Gibraltar Health Authority registration is provided for under the Social Security Employment Injuries Insurance Act. The Social Security Insurance Act, the Group Practice Medical Scheme Act, and the Group Practice Medical Scheme Regulations. Other than these, registration is possible under the United Kingdom Reciprocal Agreement Pension List, or those in possession of an E-121 from another EU country.
Question number 20, the Honourable Chair of the Society on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Okay. Can the government confirm how many consultants have been engaged by the GHA since the last January?
And for the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Speaker, since the 2019 general election, the GHA has employed 3 medical consultants.
Speaker, apart from medical consultants, are there any other consultants that have been engaged, i.e., are people been providing services on a consultancy basis to the DHA?
We think the question was asked specifically to do with medical consultants, and
Mr. Speaker, I think in answering this question, the people compiling the information have interpreted the question of being about medical consultants because of the GHA and the word consultant in the context of the GHA meaning. And so I don't want to see the minister myself venture an answer that might be incorrect. The Honourable Gentleman is right, this question is not limited to medical consultants, it's called consultants. But I think it has, in good faith, been interpreted because of the context of being a medical consultant. If you want to know whether anybody has been asked to consult in the GHA in the essence of for example, I don't know, computers, we would not be able to give them the answer today, but if they ask again, or the right person, so we can provide information. Mr. Speaker, I accept that, in good faith, it can be misinterpreted. But given that the question has already been put, rather than put us to the added burden of asking the question again, the minister has our question, and perhaps we can send my colleague a list of information, if indeed there have been people engaged as consultants or providing consultancy services for the geocaching still after lecture, you can send my colleague Mr. Phillips that information.
Happy to be speaking. Question number 21, the Honourable Chair of Society on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm average waiting time for consulting psychiatrists?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, we answer this question together with questions 22 to 25.
Question number 22, the Honourable Chair of Society on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm the number of people in 2019 who have been prescribed with antidepressants, antipsychotic medications, for the purposes of a mental health complaint?
Question number 23, the Honourable Chair of Society on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm how many patients are currently suffering under current mental health legislation?
Question number 24, the Honourable Chair of Society on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm how many patients receiving treatment for a mental health condition have a history of drug misuse, either prescribed or use of illegal drugs?
Question number 25, the Honourable Chair of Society on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm the number of acute and non-acute admissions to the Ocean View facility since we've opened its doors?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, the average waiting time for a new referral appointment for field construction psychiatrists is currently 3 weeks for a routine referral. Other patients are triaged by the mental health team, and those that present with a more acute problem are seen sooner. According to GSA's prescribing data, the number of patients prescribed antidepressants and or antipsychotic medication in 2019 was 2,974. There are currently 25 patients suffering under the mental health legislation. GSA records show that 244 patients present as having a history of drug misuse and a documented mental health issue. All admissions into Ocean View Hospital are considered as acute. There have been 715 admissions into Ocean View since its first opening. Can the Minister just help me because I cannot recall one of the questions that the Minister. Honestly, I cannot tell him the date, but I'm sure it was in our first term, and I think it was in the last year of our first term, so I believe it might have been between September 14 and October 15. I cannot even make a sense of that, and I may be completely wrong, but that is for many what I know it is. In relation to the answer on patients receiving treatment for mental health conditions with a history of drug misuse, does the Minister have a bit more information about that? He's given us the statistic of 244. Is that in a... Are those current patients being treated, or is it a broad range over a span of years?
We've had a total of 421 patients are currently recorded in EMIS as having a history of drug misuse. Of these 421, 244 have a documented
mental health problem. Sorry, thank you, that's helpful. In relation to the answer that the minister gives on the number of people in 2019 prescribed the antipsychotic medication, I think I took the numbers correctly as 3,974. I think that's the number. And obviously, that's a range of different conditions. Some will be very mild, some transitory, others will be wasted. Doesn't it agree with me that is a rather concerning statistic over a period of a year? And if the minister has not seen that statistic till now, it's because we've posed the question, or if the minister was aware of that statistic, what steps is he taking to understand that situation a bit more clearly because of the size of the
Yeah, I would like to have a guess as to whether this may well be pretty normal for a population of given size. And I could ask the professor who provided us with information, but I would like to say either if it's worrying or whether it's a conservative for the population in size. And it's something I'm not qualified to obtain. There's also one thing that we have to take into account. They are provided where people take antipsychotics, where people who take antipsychotics, and the people who take both. And this always is included, so it could be the same amount of patients from taking both medications as opposed to or just one or the other. So we really need to see what the view of the major profession, see whether it is a bad way to expect the other one.
So is the minister saying that he knows for sure or that he is speculating as to whether there is double counting in these figures?
That's what I'm saying because I have information here, which is, for example, we have in one given year, for example, there's 3,600 patients on antidepressants, 775 on antipsychotics, and 439 taking both. So I know that there's a mixture of patients here.
But then there's only 400 that are. Well, he's got a statistic, he's just given me a figure, 3,600. 400 he's taken both. But he's given me a total of 3,974. So that doesn't suggest double counting.
Well, you can say things that you see that they add is 300. Yeah, I mean, it's not the math here stands out because I had this conversation with my staff, and then I need to take their advice. The way, if you look at antidepressants and add antidepressants, so they don't take away both. That's how they are compared to the figure.
Whether there is an element of double counting or not, and the minister said, well, he's not sure whether this is a sort of normal figure. Even with some element of double counting, the number of people or sort of prescription of antidepressants and antipsychotics is quite significant. As a proportion of a population, at the very least, perhaps the minister would speak to the specialist in the field, understand whether it is the norm, and whether it is the norm or not, and have a conversation. I would urge him have a conversation, perhaps, in respect of what steps can be taken in any way to assist the causes of these issues.
Yes, absolutely. One thing I would like to mention is that mental health is something which affects most of us to very different levels and degrees. And when it comes to depression and anxiety and very mild depression, it is something which patients will be prescribed something to help them on the way. Not necessarily mean, I'm not saying that it's like something normal,
certain dysfunction, which are prescribed depending on the GP or the mental health professional. And so this is why there appears to be a huge number of people on I think it's going to start in my way, but I can't say that, and I know the division say that. But there is a massive spectrum from people who are slightly anxious, and even the portrait of students who are the study with people that are anxious, and something is challenging because mental health, you know, I know a few people who can, you know, say hand in heart that they've never been low, depressed, or anxious, and this reflects, I think, that.
Speaker, will the minister take steps to clarify this double counting in this sense? Because the question that my honourable colleague Mr. Phillips posed was, can the government confirm the number of people? Now, I appreciate that in obtaining the information, as the minister has explained, there may be an element of people taking both and double counting, but because we asked to quantify the number of people, and because it would be helpful for the government to know precisely how many people are taking one, the other, or double, and they're not double counted, so that you know the number of cases that there are in Gibraltar, will the minister take steps to drill down on the statistics in a clearer way?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's helpful. I mean, especially we'll do that exercise because I think it's worth having clarity in that respect. But it's because we have to be careful that we don't fall into traps in this respect. First of all, when we are looking at the population, rather than we need to remember that those who are entitled to prescriptions under the group practice medical scheme do not just make up the 32,000 people who are resident in Gibraltar, they also make up those who are working in Gibraltar, etc. We've been given the answer a moment ago about registration. We talk about 15,000 people working in Gibraltar, so I mean, if we were doing a rough calculation, we would be talking about approximately 47,000 people being entitled to prescriptions under the group practice medical scheme. So the base is not 32, in which 39 would be over 10%, the base is potentially 47 plus. So that's the first point. The second point, Mr. Speaker, is that in respect of mental health, I think the key issue is that people should not consider that having a mental health problem is a stigma in any way. And therefore, you will find that a lot of the thinking in this respect is that no prescriptions in respect of antidepressants should not be seen as necessarily a bad thing when we are trying to encourage people who have mental health issues to speak up and take advice and go for GP. So the first black reaction might be, as the Honourable Member has suggested, that we should all be concerned, and indeed, we must all be concerned about those who have issues of mental health to ensure that they're getting the best possible service from our GHS. But we mustn't say anything in this House, and I'm sure that the government will agree with me, and he won't want any of what he said to be interpreted in this way. And are suggesting that people who have a mental health issue should not manifest it, they should not go to their GP, and indeed that they should not have a drug prescribed. I hope that's helpful, Mr. Speaker, and I do agree with him that we need a little more clarity in respect of the statistics provided so that we do know not just those taking one or the other, but we know exactly how many are taking one or the other, and whether they're taking both or not. I certainly wasn't suggesting, and I don't think the younger member would say I was, but because of the way he just put it, I just made clear, I certainly wasn't suggesting that I adopt or accept any kind of stigma of people who have mental health issues. I mean, they certainly need addressing, and it's a good thing that people should come forward, and we need to break down barriers of accepting people with mental health issues. What I am rather concerned about, though, is that, and this is a cross-party, I believe, issue. What I'm rather concerned about is that as a society in Gibraltar, we properly grapple with the issues that are causes of mental health problems to the extent that they are not physical causes. If they are causes for
exacerbations created by factors outside the individual. For example, it might be social media bullying or any kind of issue like that, that we drill down in a better way the statistics so that we understand them, so that not only the government don't have that source of information, but as a society we understand it a bit better. And the government will not be able to address those issues unless it understands precisely the size of the number of people that are taking these medications in different categories, and then drill down on the statistics in a better way so that it understands, for example, is it predominantly younger people more than older people? And if it's younger people than older people, without specifying or breaking down barriers that of respecting the privacy and confidentiality of individuals, in discussions with specialists and interested groups and NGOs in this field, it would be important to try to come up with plans and steps to see if we can, with a better statistical analysis, address the issues that are coming up commonly, that are being spoken to specialists, that specialists that are commonly and most practitioners are understanding. And so I am giving a long intro to that question so that the Honourable Member Minister has the opportunity to agree with me that it must be in the interest of the government and society at large for the government to have a better statistical recall. The answer to that would appear to be yes. Because, of course, the issue is not whether the government, or indeed the DOJ, as I said, has the statistical results. The only issue is whether or not the information provided in answer to the question is the answer sought. Because the government, aka the DOJ, does have that information. Indeed, I'll allow the Honourable Speaker to say something else now. But what was concerning me, Mr. Speaker, was that the Honourable Gentleman was taking us down the road, and he has clarified, I think, inadvertently, of saying too many people seem to be in receiving these drugs. That must be a cause of concern. Well, Mr. Speaker, that is the opposite of the approach that I think we, as he has clarified, we are both keen to ensure that everyone says, which is that if you do have a mental health issue, we don't consider you a problem. We want you to come forward, and if you need medication, you should have that medication. And I think what he is saying, and what I agree with, and it's certainly the policy of the government, and indeed, it's certainly the policy of the government because we are advised by the professionals that it should be, is that people should be encouraged to come forward as much as possible and not be regarded as a problem or indeed a system. Now, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister will say something now about how the numbers are compiled. He should not think that the government doesn't have, aka the DOJ, that information, that breakdown by age group, that breakdown by sex. It's quite another thing to see whether they have sought it, which I don't think they have, or indeed if they have sought it, whether we have given it in this house. And the important thing is not so much that we should have it, but I mean, if any of the members want it and it is available, we should and we should. I put it to him, perhaps potentially debate it in the context of a different part of the process of the South, because the professionals in the GHA certainly do have it, and I didn't like his use of the word grapple with, but that's a professional style. Certainly, working with it to understand how best to deal with the issues that manifest. Mr. Speaker, I will forever be sad that I had a very, very close personal friend who didn't manifest, who didn't take an antidepressant, and therefore isn't with us now. Mr. Speaker, I'm sorry that certainly that was a matter of regret, and that last comment was to me, and I share that with him. And I'm sorry that he didn't like my use of the word grappling, despite his love of man-to-man contact. Given his comment that the government is in possession of a breakdown by of age group, can the minister illuminate us in respect of that?
I think I would have to that question would be asked independently. I don't have that information. Well, I do stand up to explain, you mentioned whether I could discuss whether there is double counting. And if you look at the position which is required, the answer to question 22 is a number of 3,974 patients. And we did a breakdown, people went on to the surface of 2,638, people antipsychotics, 775, on both, 439. So if you add 2,638 to 775 and deduct 439, you get 2,174, which is the answer given to the question. There's double counting.
Okay, but precisely for that reason, then there must be no double counting. And the minister might agree. He just told me there is no double counting.
The speaker would have said that there are people who have been double counting. Because if someone takes you onto the question, if you take the amount of patients, so if a patient is taking antidepressants by those taking antipsychotics, then you see that the reason that would take place. If you take 2,174 patients, so of which 2,600 are on antidepressants and of which 775 are antipsychotics, if you add those together, you get a number greater than 2,174. So when you deduct those, you can double. And this is a figure that's been provided.
Precisely. So what he's done is he's added the 3,600 to the ones that are the 725, and then deducted. You come up to, roughly speaking, 4,400 plus, and you've deducted it. So you move the double counted one. So. Correct. And therefore, the figure, in a second, I just think there's the point in there, as I know. So in effect, you've removed the 439 that are taking place, you remove the double counting, so the 3,974 excluded the double counting. Is that not correct?
Can I just advise, if possible, that we might make some progress with all the members at the end of this particular part of the question time? This algebraic part of the debate to the antechamber where we have coffee and then agree the number. I mean, I don't think we need to have a debate about the number. We just look at the number and tell him why we think it says one thing, and then we can make a decision together as to what the number represents. I don't think question time is about doing mathematics together. No, Mr. Speaker, question time is not about doing mathematics. The question time is about extracting information, and what I was trying to extract is the correct explanation, because before I was giving the explanation that there was an element of double counting, and what we now know is that 3,974 is the correct number without the double counting. But if we need to discuss it again, we will. Now, the issue is, can I move on to another supplementary on the number of questions that we asked. In relation to question 25, if I may, the Honourable Minister says 715 admissions to HMV doesn't have a statistic on the length of the average stage of those admissions or not. I appreciate that we haven't asked that question, so if he doesn't have it, we ask it again. People, I wouldn't be able to understand the information being given to there. That's not something which I think would have been interpreted as a legitimate part of the question, but
we have one last question on the subject.
Mr. Speaker, I was trying to interject for a while because I think there's something that's escaped all of us, and maybe I'll be assisting the leader of the opposition here, who will be forgiven perhaps for not being aware of this, seeing as he was not a member of the House last year when I asked the government questions, because a very large pharmaceutical company had actually made the DHA aware of its concerns, and I believe it may have been Pfizer. Warning us that the levels of antidepressants and benzodiazepines, which are the main ingredient of these antidepressants that are used today, that for a population of 30,000, too many people were using and procuring the pharmaceuticals from them, and that is only one company saying it's confirmed. And now when it comes Pfizer, we see that about 10% of the population is on antidepressants and antipsychotics after such a warning, which could have put alarm bells ringing throughout the entire data. I find it really shocking and alarming, even though I could understand that the new health minister, you know, has not been aware, but I believe in this case a really strong brief that has been given to him in handover to come up with a strategy based on this advice and warning, and that the fact that the minister has no awareness of this concern or of these numbers until now, it seems, and how we're going to curb things is extremely worrying. And I want to know what government has done actively since Pfizer, I believe it was Pfizer, mistake, pharmaceuticals issued these warnings to the voters, given that it appears that nobody has any idea of the levels of oversubscription. And don't forget, Mr. Speaker, we're talking about the numbers of people only in GHA. We have to assume that there are also another portion of the community that's getting them privately. So it's probably much more than 10% of our community, and that is a very concerning figure. So I would like to know what the government has done about it since the pharmaceutical warning.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the other lady is receiving with very good respect for the care. The Pfizer warning was about opioids and the opioid crisis, Mr. Speaker, and that led, Mr. Speaker, to a question from the government of a whole program to reduce not the subscription but the prescription of opioids in the GOK, which is a current and ongoing program, Mr. Speaker. But the other lady needs to realize that she fell into the same kind of leadership the position was falling into. And I say accept because I don't think either of them mean to do this. If there are people with mental health issues in our community, then that is 15%, 20%, or 28%, which appears to be the average in other countries, then we've got a problem if we haven't got 28% of those people somehow being prescribed the drugs that they need if they need a drug. So we shouldn't be concerned, Mr. Speaker, that it appears that 10% of our population is taking these drugs. We should be concerned if there is one person in our community who needs these drugs who isn't taking them, as much as we should be concerned about one person in our community who doesn't need these drugs, or who doesn't need them any longer, continuing to take them or be prescribed them. Those are the key issues. And the Pfizer issue is unrelated to this issue. It's related to a completely different crisis, which is equally important, but which does not relate to mental health. It relates to a different issue, which is the opioid crisis, which affects many Western nations and is affecting people as well. And although members can look at the questions issued by the government at the time that this issue arose. Mr. Speaker, does the Chief Minister not agree with me that rather than just that, because I do agree with a lot of what he said, but it doesn't end there. Surely the government are concerned not just about that, but also about understanding better and tackling the causes of mental health, and also understanding and tackling better the adequacy of the medication taking, because we also are exposed to a number of programs. I saw one last year on the BBC about the adequacy and effectiveness of young people taking certain antipsychotic or antidepressant medication and how it doesn't work and how people are being prescribed these things automatically. And that is a matter for not just clinicians but for government and for societies at large to grapple with, where they are rooted again, grapple with the idea whether we are giving our young people antidepressants and antipsychotics when there are better ways of tackling these things, and does the government not agree with that? Mr. Speaker, we are in violent agreement with that. And it's not a little to grapple with, it's a little to resolve, Mr. Speaker. So we're looking to resolve it by having an argument across the floor of this house. We're looking to resolve it by giving the resources to the professionals who are going to advise us, who are trained as advocates but not as psychologists and psychiatrists, to be able to determine in which instances there may be an over-prescription or an under-prescription. Because both are equally dangerous, Mr. Speaker. If somebody takes more of a drug than they need, they are put in danger. And if somebody doesn't take a drug that they need or takes less of a drug than they need, they are also potentially in danger. This is the key point to put across. We should not be concerned about the amount of drugs being prescribed if they have a right amount of drugs being prescribed. We should certainly be concerned about drugs being prescribed if they don't need to be prescribed. Now, Mr. Speaker, this is an issue where we have managed to show the community that even though we agree
about it. Now, I think I would commend to the other members that then you have either make a difference in this house or speak to the minister next in this house in order to see what we can do together and constructively to do more about mental health issues, whether they're affecting young people or the elderly. Because if you can just talk about young people, but what about the mental health people affecting the elderly or Alzheimer's, dementia? These are equally concerning things that cannot just be treated with chemicals, and chemicals could be a last resort. I have my views, but my views are the views of an observer, a politician, and an advocate. They're not the views of a professional. I put it to them that they're his, and that we rightly take an interest in these things as members of this parliament who are here to shape the future of our community, but we must be led by the clinicians on these issues. So I don't think it's because that this is anything further, that there is anything further that we can back to and fro from each other on this issue in the House, but it is an issue of concern for all of us.
Next question, I'm sorry. It's next question.
Question number 26, the Honourable Chair of the Society on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state why the mental health audit has not been published?
I'm from the Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, this document is still under review. Yeah, Mr. Speaker, how long has it been under review, and when does the government expect it to be published?
Mr. Speaker, this document has been under review for a couple of months. In fact, it was in June 2019.
That's 7 months, not a couple. When do they expect to publish it?
Mr. Speaker, although the document, in fact, this document, I will say, was actually produced for the Public Health England. It was produced by the then Minister for Health and also Minister for Public Health. So this is something which is dealt with primarily public health. We need to take stock of what the document says. That does not mean to say that certain recommendations in the document have not been put into effect. In fact, quite a few of the recommendations of the document have already been put into effect. Now, just because the document hasn't been made public yet does not mean that it is put in effect and nothing happens. Things are many things that happen as a result of that. But while I would like to take full to grasp the document in its entirety. I will be meeting with Minister Cortez, who is the Minister responsible for public health, and then we will take a great decision on this matter.
Mr. Speaker, that last answer suggests that what was received is not a draft document, but a final document, and we're reviewing it and implementing certain recommendations and so on. Why did it take 7 months to publish the mental health audit, even if the government were implementing certain things and not implementing others, implementing certain in a different plan? Why does it take 7 months to publish it when the Chief Minister has just indicated that he agreed that mental health is so important?
Mr. Speaker, the reason why it's taking so long to make public is because we are looking at the seeking advice and eventually from the healthcare professionals on this. But I said, just because the report has not been made public does not mean that things are not moving. In fact, on the contrary, things are moving and we're taking heed. The government has taken heed and I'm pretty sure took heed of the results of this program. And many things are already have happened and that will become evident in due course.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure that Honourable Member did answer when he expects to publish it. Secondly, can he at least tell us the scope of this audit? What is it that it addresses? We haven't seen it, so it's difficult to have a conversation. You know, the organization has indicated that the report will be published as soon as he is able to go through the course of action he has determined
1954 is published. What is the audit about? It is a mental health, an audit into mental health in Gibraltar. What is the Honourable Gentleman doing? Well, Mr. Speaker, what the Honourable Gentleman is doing, and he's writing a question, is demonstrating that he agrees entirely with the position that we have taken in government to public support. Only when he has forgotten, perhaps he wants to forget. When he was the leader of the PDP and I was the leader of the JSF Liberals, so there was a whole swathe of reports that the former government, of the party that he now leads, was not public. It was their policy, the GSP's policy, not to publish reports when they were in office. Now, Mr. Speaker, our policy is to publish. But sometimes there are things that we have to do before we publish. So the answer we've got is we are going to publish, and the audit is about mental health in Gibraltar. As soon as it is published, we will be able to see in detail exactly what was investigated, exactly by who, and exactly what their conclusions were. Because as long as the Honourable Minister is saying, well, look, I've got to look at what parts of this I redact, he's saying, I've just got to make sure that with the new Minister for Public Health, I have dealt with any necessary issues that may be required before publication. So, Mr. Speaker, I think what he would be asking with is wanting to salute the approach of the current and past Minister of Health, of first of all commissioning this report, and second, being committed to publishing it as soon as possible. Mr. Speaker, rather than smoke screens and ballots, let's concentrate on the issue, because what I do remember as Minister for Health when I sat on that side is how quickly we published the report in shortly after 1997 that we got into the health service. Mr. Speaker, the government has had this report for 7 months. Can the Minister not at least indicate to me, or the Chief Minister indicate to me, having read these reports, which presumably they already have, what these reports broadly contain? What is the scope of these reports? The scope of the report is ordered into mental health in Gibraltar. The recommendations contained are what members who have carried out that report suggest we should do in order to improve mental health in Gibraltar, and the date of the report publication will be as soon as the current Minister for Health and the current Minister for Public Health are able to confirm its publication if possible without causing any difficulties or problems. Because we need to ensure that there is nothing in there that will cause a problem of breach of data protection, etc. The Honourable Gentleman might also like to reflect that there's been a small matter of a general election in between the period of the ending of the work of that report and today, and therefore, Mr. Speaker, if there has been an element of greater delay than this government might have wished to see in the publication, well, we, of course, wish that had not been the case, but given that we are committed to publication, Mr. Speaker, he will be pleased to see that our attitude is not the attitude of at least that I might establish a latter day of the GOP in government, given that he reminds us that he was responsible for publication of a report in 1997 when he was Minister of Health. I assume then, saying how badly things have been going until 1996,
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Chief Minister's intervention. I was listening to him in a taxi on the way here. And one question I had, and the reason why this question is generated in the first place, is a number of characters approached me in respect of the mental health audit. They have been approached and consulted quite widely, it is said, by the government in respect of the audit. Now, my question relates to the purpose of the audit, which I know the leader of the opposition talked about the scope. However, the purpose of this audit, as far as I understand, I'd like the government to confirm this, is so to develop a strategy moving forward with the Gibraltar. You can't understand, in my respectful view, the extent of the problem unless you can deal with the audit. Now, I understand from the Minister's response to the question previously, was that by piecemeal incorporation of certain ideas that were thrown around the room in relation to the audit, they're now incorporating them. Isn't the right approach with this? It's to publish the report that at some point in the future, that identifies the existence of the problem and how we intend to deal with it, so that the mental health charities in our community can understand what they need to do to support the government.
I've never been happier to welcome the Honourable Gentleman to the South, and to thank him for agreeing wholeheartedly with the policy of the government.
Next question. Question number 27, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm what steps are taken for the use of private of cannabinoid derivatives for medicinal purposes?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
he will due to have established a panel of medicinal cannabis practitioners. The next step will be to provide training to these practitioners to then be able to authorize medicinal cannabis for patient use.
And just so that we can be clear as far as the cannabis practitioners are concerned, where do they derive their qualifications from?
These are a group of participants who have shown interest in the subject, and the actual education will come from a company called Grad Science UK, which is an independent government advisory body for the use of medicinal cannabis in the UK. So they will be providing the relevant training for them to be able to be able to work in the field.
Next question, question number 28, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state how it intends to manage the 3 to 5 weekly dementia diagnosis rate?
I think the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, over the 6 month period between July to December 2019, 45 new diagnoses of dementia were made. This equates to 1.7 new diagnosis a week and not 3 to 5 as the honourable member's question referred to. However, the government is fully committed to supporting these patients by consolidating the services provided by the dementia day centre and providing support to relatives and carers. The care agency today provides domiciliary care to approximately 90 persons living with dementia or Alzheimer's. These services provide support for the activities of daily living to promote independence and daily admission into and delay admission into hospital or residential care.
Speaker, I just want to mention in relation to that point. The information I haven't just plucked from thin air, in fact, we know reflected by public statements by Dr. Benjamin that he takes the view that there are between 3 and 5 weekly dementia, and clearly Dr. Benjamin is involved at the grassroots level and ground level in relation to dementia. Obviously, been honoured by the Majesty of the Queen recently in relation to his work within our community. So there seems to be Dr. Benjamin's view in relation to the weekly diagnosis and the government's actual statistic. Can the government be helpful why there is this disparity in figures?
Dr. Benjamin, we have the congratulations of everyone in the House for the way in which Your Majesty has recognized his magnificent work for the community. And it wasn't for the diagnosis of dementia. It was for the cumulative work that he has done for this community, in particular in the field of medicine, but not just in the field of medicine, also in the field of charity. The data that we are dealing with is the data of the Gibraltar Health Authority. And Dr. Benjamin has said that in his study, he has given an estimate of what he thinks the rate of diagnosis is. This is the actual rate of diagnosis. Look at this. One, it's worrying. And we have an issue to, I'm not going to say grumpy, I'll just say deal with, Mr. Speaker. But those are the things that honourable members need to realise that it's quite something to deal with what is said and quite another to deal with what is actually statistically happening. Now, scientifically, we have to work on the numbers that we have, not on what we think might be happening. And I also think to them, Mr. Speaker, they want to criticise how much we spend and how much we have increased spending. But one of the ways that we have principally increased spending is spending on these issues. We opened these facilities to look after those with dementia and Alzheimer's. We opened the day centres to look after them, and we increased massively the domiciliary care. That has added many millions of pounds of expenditure to our bottom line. It's exactly the right sort of thing to be spending on. Just to correct the record, I think it was said in the context, of course, in an interview on GBC, where he was put the correlation between pollution in our community and the increased incidence of dementia within our community. And that's what I'm driving at, is what do we have in place to cater for that? Because clearly the health budget of the future will need to take into account of not only mental health, but also dementia, and the huge pressures in our community from these elements of incestuous into our community. And that's the reason why I asked the question, so that I have written information as to how the government intends to deal with it. And I appreciate the point made by the Chief Minister that money's been plowed into it
But I want to know how it's going to be dealt with in the future, looking at the very large budget, the financial budget we have for the health service, and how we can manage those millions in the future.
In particular, there's another question in the order paper that deals with the issue of budget and dementia. So I'm surprised that the older gentleman brought it up in this context. But everything in relation to dementia and Alzheimer's is changing. Why we get it, how to deal with it, how to keep it at bay, how to treat it if treating it is possible, how to treat those with it and how to approach them. All of those things that form the basis of the approach that the government is taking and the dementia strategy which the government has worked on with DAD and others. All of these things together are how the government is dealing with it. But all of these things involve expense. You can normally get up and criticize how much you spend. They don't say, look, actually, I'm only complaining about this million, but all the other 5 million, those are fine because we agree that we have to deal with issues like dementia. So there's never been time with that. At that point, what we say is there should be priority in government spending for mental health, obesity, dementia care. It is an ever-increasing amount of money that's being spent on our health service, and in many circumstances, quite rightly. What we ask is, we'll go on to another question related to it from the more generally, how we control that budget moving and can we afford it, Mr. Speaker? Mr. Speaker, the issue is not that we can have a strategy of how to deal with things and that we should ensure that we provide the best possible care. It's that we should control how much we spend. I didn't realize that a story of austerity was once again at the heart of the question.
Question number 29, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can you demonstrate what percentage of the annual health budget is dedicated to mental health for business?
I'm the only minister for health and care.
Mr. Speaker, we answer the question together with question 30.
Question number 30, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can you demonstrate what percentage of the annual health budget is dedicated to the mental provision?
I'm the Honourable minister for health and care.
Mr. Speaker, it is impossible to provide a meaningful reply to either of these questions because mental health conditions, including dementia, will impact on all areas of the DHH, including the primary care center, endowed hospitals, and OCDs. There will also be an impact on elderly care services as well as domiciliary care. Effect funding for mental health care and dementia are intrinsic parts of all health and elderly care provision and therefore cannot be separated in any meaningful way.
Has the mental health audit that the Minister guards so carefully made any recommendations in respect of a separate mental health project as a whole?
The Honourable General will be able to read exactly all the recommendations contained in that audit when it is published.
Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister must have the advantage over after having read it. And so does the Minister. I'm asking him. Despite guarding the secrecy of this report for the moment and going to publish it in due course, does it contain any recommendations in respect of the mental health budget?
See, the funding that is going to be published is not secret, it is just not yet published.
Mr. Speaker, are we going to prolong these exchanges anymore with the Chief Minister failing to answer a question that the people of Gibraltar will want answered as to whether this report contains recommendations in respect of the mental health budget?
No, Mr. Speaker, the government of Gibraltar is going to ensure that the people of Gibraltar have a full and complete disclosure of an audit into mental health services in Gibraltar, which only this government has built, which goes into all issues of mental health, and which should not be seen or looked in isolation at any one particular part, simply because it might tick the box or tickle the fancy of members of the opposition.
Mr. Speaker, has the Minister received recommendations or has it been discussed in the Department as to whether the mental health services should be provided for in a separate way within the budget? They should be split in some kind of subhead or accounted for in a different way?
Mr. Speaker, honourable members will know, I know that it's some time since the honourable member has looked at the budget book in this House, but you'll know that there is a very clear line by line almost in the pages that relate to the DHA of how much is spent on Ocean News, how much is spent, etc. So the Honourable Gentleman is able to do that. And the question is, if you ask about a particular mental health ailment, and this is the point, because the their question is not about what is the cost of the mental health services, etc. They're asking about one ailment and asking what the budget is across the group during that respect. That is what kind of gets separated. The question is geared towards mental health provision in our community, but also drilled down on dementia provision. Now, the Minister for Health is unable to answer that question, because, as he says, it's part of all of our services and so far as health is concerned. But the budget book itself talks about the dementia care centre, the dementia residential facility, about £4 million. All I'm asking for is a global percentage for the provision of mental health in our community, which I'm sure he's able to do. If he gets the calculator out, I'll get those items that are contained in the budget to give a percentage so this community understands to what extent the government is dedicating resources to mental health in our community. Every country in the world can do that. Why can't we? Mr. Speaker, bravado does not avail the Honourable Gentleman of greater logic. He doesn't even understand the question that he's asked, I'm sorry to say. Of course, within the budget book, there is provision for the mental health service for Ocean View, etc. But if that is the question that he's asking, Mr. Speaker, if that is the question that he's asking, then he gives himself away because it's public information. And what he's asking us to do is to calculate as a percentage of the figure at the bottom of that part of the book before the one that he's referring to or whatever else it is. He is asking what percentage of the annual budget is dedicated to mental health provision. Mr. Speaker, we have not interpreted that as being something we as country to the rules on questions in the South. I can you please do the division for me of which bit relates to those parts of the health authority that are exclusively about mental health from the whole of the budget? If that were what he was asking, Mr. Speaker, then the question would have been out of order. People have a very simple question as to whether the government can give a percentage for the provision of mental health in communities. Clearly, the government is unable to satisfy those members of our community that would like to know how much the government is spending on mental health more generally. So the government clearly acknowledges the question that they're unable to do so. That's right, isn't it? No, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to now do it a little more slowly. The budget book sets out specifically in relation to the DHA, what DHA spending is on. In respect of those parts of DHA spending which are specifically on mental health, he cannot surely have been asking us to work out what a percentage that is of the total of spending on the DHA. Because not only are we able to do so in this community, as he says, every community or nation is able to do, if that is the question he was asking, he would be able to do it from the publicly available information that is already public. And if that is the case, Mr. Speaker, then his question is, by reason of his explanation, out of order. But, Mr. Speaker, because we believe him to be asking a most sophisticated question, which perhaps we should not have ascribed to his questioning, despite the fact that this community has spent a small fortune in training him as an advocate and cross-examiner, Mr. Speaker, it is not possible to do that further analysis. I hope I said it clearly enough. Next question, or Mr. Speaker, may I? Just to elucidate the House, I really cannot find in the budget book the cost of Ocean View. And I would be grateful if Chief Minister would put that on board in reply to my honourable colleague, and I suppose it would be more costly. Certainly, the cost of the dementia residential facility is in the book, as is the long-term care dementia facility. But certainly, we made this point in the past. The cost of mental health, direct costs, which are easily attributable, for example, Ocean View, are not in the book. So, would the Chief Minister accept that my honourable question is entirely reasonable? Of course not, Mr. Speaker, because just because the Honourable Gentleman says he cannot find it in the book today doesn't mean that it's not there. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, honourable members have fallen into the trap of voting against the budget since the Honourable Mr. Clinton arrived on the scene
the debate and the carrying, and has decided not to walk out today, as he did last time, and he didn't like the answer he was getting, Mr. Speaker. So I don't accept any of what he has said. I don't believe that either he or I are the arbiters of whether a question is reasonable or proper. I think that is you, Mr. Speaker.
Next question, and I suppose, given that we've been at it for 2 hours, and maybe we've managed to get through 30 of the questions that we have, that we should take a short break and return at 5:25.
The House will recess until 5:25.
Question number 31, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
What is the short staffing deficit of nursing hours at AME and St. Bernard Hospital for the month of December?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, I'll answer the question together with questions 32 to 36.
Question number 32, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
What is the minimum speciality grade level requirement to work in AME as a worker?
Question number 43, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
How many AME doctors are employed by the DHA and how many of those are in the specialist register?
Question number 44, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
How many AME doctors work at the St. Bernard Hospital nightshift?
Question number 45, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
What is the St. Bernard's AME consultant's ratio of clinic to non-clinical hours per week?
Question number 36, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
Who covers pediatric emergencies out of hours on site?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, the total number of nursing deficit hours for the month of November or December at Accident and Emergency was 476. The objectives working within the Accident and Emergency Department to possess a basic medical qualification, previous experience of having worked in a similar department, and be registered with the General Medical Council. The DHA currently employs a total of 7 non-consulting hospital doctors in the Accident and Emergency Department. One associate specialist and one consultant. The consultant is listed on the specialist list of the General Medical Council. The Accident and Emergency Department at the Internal Hospital is staffed by 2 doctors until midnight. Between the hours of midnight and 9 a.m., the department is staffed by 1 A&E doctor. The formal death plan for the A&E consultant stipulates a ratio of 70% clinical and 30% non-clinical work. However, this is just a guide as the demands of the department vary widely on a daily basis and clinical needs always take priority. The DHA team of pediatric consultants provides an out-of-hours on-call rota. Any pediatric emergency presenting at the Accident and Emergency Department will be attended to by the resident A&E team in the first instance. Any hospital-based pediatric emergency occurring outside of the A&E department will be attended to by the resident intensivist and intensivist registrar team. In either case, interim on-site cover is provided until the arrival of the on-call duty pediatric consultant.
Mr. Speaker, I just want to point out that the line of my questioning is mainly to highlight the fact that I understand that there seems to be a situation where many doctors who are not seniors or known as registrars or consultants are having to take the load for directing and making decisions, causing a lot of stress faithful in the doctors, and from what I understand and what the minister has explained, having one doctor only on the night shift after midnight leaves little room for when doctors call in sick or when there is understaffing, especially when we hear that there have been in 1 month 476 hours of short staffing. So my question is, doesn't it concern the government that there is a massive load of doctors who are not specialists in their field, and something that could pose a high liability on their shoulders if things go wrong? I mean, it could lead to the DMC investigating safe practices and goods. For example, are these numbers, are these short staffing numbers adequate considering the figures that we have just had?
Because the fact that there's one doctor overnight is the when the admin agency can be extremely busy or can be there be live where there's no one to the scene. If, for example, there is a need to call in extra doctors in case there's something unexpected, then they can be called in separately. But to have a top consultant in A&E constantly, even at times when there's no need, when the doctors can adequately look after most of the cases that come through, and with this lack of useful method of resources available.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know about when the minister says he talks about top doctors. I think it's regular practice to have an overall registrar consultant on top of the work of the A&E doctors. From what I understand, there was a staffing or a system failure on the night of the 2nd of January where there was no A&E specialty. Is there anything that the minister could tell me about what failure may have led to this? Because, of course, this could have had a massive impact on patients.
Because I have already spoken about the student patient questions, if I have the information sources, we want to ask regarding that because I'm happy to speak information. One thing that the young lady has, I think, maybe mixed together is when she asked in 2021 about the short staffing deficit in terms of nursing hours, the relationship that with the doctor. And since then, there has been a recruitment drive to fill in nursing and vacancies in the acting and the relationship with a lot of the work based on higher in acting and relationship is of a nursing nature. In fact, the CI nurses will have a very good depth of seeing patients in the first 10 to 15 minutes before I'm told, and are very quickly able to recommend the course of action, whether they will be urgent, whether they will be brought in quicker, and if it's something which is not so urgent, or something which can wait, then other patients are given the priority. So that is the difference between the questions we asked in 2021, which is about nursing hours and doctors, which is the second part of the group of questions.
Mr. Speaker, if I were to tell the minister that many of the doctors feel burnt out because they feel that the focus should be on the senior doctor, which there isn't enough of care shift, and that this is what is contributing to the low morale, the low staffing level, something which is actually dangerous for the community and detrimental to the staff. And would this be something that the minister would concur with, and something that perhaps government is looking to increase in terms of their A&E senior doctor's complement?
Mr. Speaker, I would be quite upset about this because since I took office after election, I made the point to start to know all the participants and the consultants. It's a very good process. I'm meeting them sometimes one to one, sometimes in groups. So if the type of department has issues that they want to raise, my door is in my office is open to choose them. And as I said, I've spoken to many consultants and surgeons, and we had the candid discussions of what their aims are and what they want to achieve, and we have discussed what the government's policies are in that respect. So if there is such an issue, then I would like to know. And as I said, I will be calling on this group of doctors and consultants in due course, and it is really necessary. I will is a very different request, and I would make the point to see them 300 days we can discuss the issues, and if they have learned the right, see how we can address them. But it is a bit surprising that they would like to tell you in that respect, or difficulty with you, and what they, I don't think I'm that to be considered someone who is unapproachable in that respect, since I took office as Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, I'd just like to clarify that the information that reaches me, of course, is of a sensitive and anonymous nature, and I am not saying that any doctor has spoken to me. I'm speaking gathering reports from good sources, not numerology, and I'm not at liberty to confirm or deny whether I had a meeting with a group of any doctors. I'm just fulfilling my role as an opposition spokesperson, as they would when they were in opposition, which is exactly what the people of the vote are paying for. One more question, Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Minister says that when there are pediatric emergencies those trained with basic medical skills and knowledge attend and they wait for a consultant in pediatric specialty to come. Would the Minister not concur that in most centres, most AME centres, in the NHS in the UK, for example, there is always a pediatric specialist on site in AME, because this is my understanding and this is what we do not have here.
Yes, to answer my question, I genuinely can say I do not know. I will ask for it. Coming back to the first thing, I mean, unless if people are feeling demoralized and outraged, I'm happy. And I'm not saying that you say this justice or I don't believe the matter you saw. But whether that raises concerns, I mean, I think if you have had these concerns for a while, I mean, there's nothing stopping you from contacting me and bringing it to my attention, so I can maybe act quicker. And I'm hoping that happens just a very short time ago, because I was just waiting for a long time that it took. But I can't help unless, you know, it's either because they speak, you know, an appointment with me, or whether because it's my time to see when I call them in, or whether the young lady or indeed, you know, someone of course, if they decide to let me know. And coming back to the question of the pediatrician, I will need to find out whether, you know, it is common practice in other places. Most of the ailments that I receive in AME, thankfully, are minor things. A lot of things are sometimes it's children with severe illnesses who use AME more as if it was, you know, a clinic. But if there is a need to an emergency acute case and it cannot be, you know, addressed sufficiently or quickly enough, if they report a physician, there is always a physician on call, not necessarily there, they're not there, they're not living there, they're not waiting for somebody, but they are on call, they can be summoned as they leave, they have 30 minutes waiting time. So within 30 minutes, and most of what the doctors, trained doctors, physicians will do, the doctors and early staff will stabilize it. First of all, it's clear, the nurse will make sure we see what the issues are, and if it's something the doctors will do the best on that, and if it's successfully, to stabilize the patient, if it's needed, and then within the 30 minutes top, you will have the on-call physician on site. So I think for a small place like Volta where people are small, I mean, that is quite reasonable. But then I kind of compare to what happens in the UK, and I would like to see the future of such things. I will, you know, do my best to see what their views are.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Honourable Gentleman for his genuinely good will answer, and I appreciate that, as I'm sure anybody working in the field would. The main concerns that I have flagged up have been the reality that regular doctors not on the specialist register are acting as senior decision makers, putting their own GMC at risk, and where they can't say anything beyond their level of competence. And this is what I believe is causing the burnout. So I would ask the Minister, in the spirit of goodwill which he has shown, whether he would commit here to holding talks in the coming weeks as soon as possible with those in the A&E department in order to really understand, because I understand that he has just taken on this portfolio, to understand and work towards ensuring that levels of staffing are acceptable in place and appropriate for the type of traffic and demographic that goes in and out of A&E.
Do you mind if I see anything that seems to be nice thing in the UK? I mean, I don't think it's uncommon. Again, I would need to talk to the consultants when I do see them. I'm hoping to have this sort of doctor as frontline defense within the defense department. As I said, there's always a place at hand, and even when it comes to cases of somebody to be fed or what have you, complications, there are always people. But I don't think it's uncommon to have doctors at this level. They are in a great training, they have had experience, and we don't have people or doctors then that have not shown adequate experience in this field of medicine. So we don't have a GP, for example, sitting at the university of the person who has had at least 5 years of medical education class that you have been to get into that level. And as I said, even if there is a new team, everyone is in a very serious, everyone can be called in and is necessary. And if you look at the report, I don't think it's considered to be a health service well known for providing good care. And yes, we have had times when people wait within A&E for what is perceived as unusable times. When you compare that to what is normal in my experience in UK hospitals, I don't think we have about it, especially because of CLAD. If the answer system is so good that within 15 minutes they're very effective, and if it's not something which is urgent, then you are to wait. What we also don't have sight of as patients in actual relationship is what coming back to the out to a year ago. So ambulances can come in and what seems like a waiting room which doesn't move apart from the drive, it generally is because we have more serious patients with perhaps, MIs or coming through the ambulance and from the back. I think you can understand the way they work, and I commend them for the work that they do. I think it's an extremely important part of our school.
Mr. Speaker, just to support the Honourable Lady, because I've heard some of the things that she has related to the floor of the House. One of the problems in actually is the emergency thermal information or the information that comes to me is that the senior consultant is actually the emergency very nicely work at Netflix. So over a period of time, what that does is it causes an undue disproportionate burden to be placed on the shoulders of those junior doctors. And of course, that may help be contributing to a sense of loss of morale, perhaps even burnout, in relation to those doctors. Just to know whether that senior consultant does match it and that he is having information after how many nights a week, for example, he works, or is the information exactly the same as ours, which is a line, I should say, that the senior consultant doesn't actually work at nights and actually is an emergency.
As far as the information that I have received, and it's part of the answer to question 34, which I already mentioned, that between the hours of midnight and 9 a.m., the department is passed by one acting to the emergency doctor, which is what I consider is being sufficient for the needs and the regular time. But obviously, with a caveat that should there be a need for extra support, it can be dialed in. Now, what we get me is that I'm a being of very short period of time, but a lot of doctors and a lot of surgeons and consultants have already asked to come and see me regularly for these third ideas, and it always should come with ambitions for the service or whatever. And I think my goal is open that if there is that discontent, or that in relation to the time, my goal has been open, and a lot of people have come willing forward, and said, I haven't said that pressure or that discontent. I mean, obviously, I will meet them in due course, unless they make a, do I have a schedule for a busy day? unless the lending unit is particularly important, then to this decision, I always find out what we use. But as far as I'm aware, you know, because it's too hard to work for rent, you know, because most of the cases are uncomplicated cases, as I've mentioned earlier, then, you know, they're exactly which adequately they service provide at the moment. And I should also like to also offer a healthy warning as well of the nature of the Honourable Lady, that the Honourable Lady is not assumed that the sexes are actually a company. I make no comment about sexes in any way, shape, or form for obvious reasons. Because you ought to look at, and you would really undertake to look at, what doctors working in that nightclub to ascertain whether in fact there is a disproportionate burden on some doctors, in particular junior doctors and actually as an emergency, can then potentially have an impact on morale of those junior doctors. Because look, I'm not a doctor, and I know very little about these issues, just what is reported to me from those that may come to see me. But it does seem unfair that if we have a situation where it's always junior doctors that are effectively there at accident and emergency, the senior guy does not work right. And I leave that with the Honourable Minister. I also say that, in fact, exactly the same report came to me about the 2nd of January, when there were no doctors that actually had an emergency and they had to be covered from outside the department. So that again, that was something the Honourable Gentleman would be undertaking to look into the figure. With that, I can't speak specifically of this case in question, but generally, in my general view, you know, something can happen whereby there is an issue and someone, you know, could say, it could come to work, someone could say, sick, someone could. But obviously, there is a system in place whereby added cover would come in. So then I would need, if that person is asked specifically, I endeavor to find out what actually happened on that date and report back to you. So I will continue to look at, you know, at that department and see what can be done or what is happening at the other end. But really, I'm not saying that just what they do or maybe that patients are perceiving waiting time as being adequate and saying, I've waited, you know, 12 to see more. They won't say that because it's the argument. Because the feedback I get is that you'll be seen, you know, very quickly, you take your blood pressure, your pulse, your vital signs, and they know exactly the professionals that they do, and they know exactly, you know, when someone can wait and someone cannot wait. So that's not the case. You work fast, you can take longer, and this is where I assume, you know, people that you represent, you know, when you come and talk to you, and the decisions we talk to you about, and probably coming from feedback from patients and what they perceive when they speak to doctors and say, why is it taking so long or whatever. But that is an inevitable part of any institution I've actually been related to.
So just one question in relation to the labour hour point that was raised by both the Honourable Gentleman and the Honourable Lady. And I know that the Minister has spoken to us. I think we've spoken to the Minister because, of course, the doctors want to see him as well. My question is whether the government has given any thought to looking at career progression within this particular area, i.e. looking at whether you can move from a system of MPhD doctors, as we've had for many, many years, to a senior house, like the first senior house, like the physician and registrar position, so that we can improve career opportunities within the service, so that doctors feel that they are moving along a career path within the service. And I think this is particularly effective in AME, again, for the concerns that have been raised by both the young gentlemen and the lady in relation to doctors specifically. I just wonder whether he's, you know, in his consultations with the doctors, explored this possibility.
As I said earlier, I have no opportunity to speak to this group of doctors as a specific part of the hospital organisation. I think you look at the usual criminal entity that I would use in ours, as in the UK when you have a change in our services, when you have a lot of houses within our services, a registered criminal agency society. That might become, you know, the non-consulting doctor who is grouped in that broader spectrum in the name. So I think
again, in my experience, without having had this information from a professor that working in the hospital, I think that a job as national relations one is generally is short-lived. I think there is obviously a bit of progress. I don't think it's something that you must really love bringing that or that acute, you know, or that acute in type of medicine you want to remain there. And so they have a big hospital or maybe, you know, trying to get operation and for some reason they become too bad as well. I mean, there is. And I do think that they have to design on it, but I really, before I don't even feel any sharing, you know, with my students that I would not be the only thing that I think that has, you know, at something certain. But I said, as I delve deeper into the DSA, which is my intention, you know, I would like to learn more about accumulation, and I would enjoy the study of the medical meetings, and things that way, you know, my previous life as a medical.
Just one question for you, Willie. Insofar as the 476 hours are concerned, does the honourable gentleman know what that represents as a percentage of the total amount of hours available for work?
No, Mr. Speaker, I wouldn't be able to, unless I'm running through my notes, I wouldn't be able to give you a percentage. The guy was limited to the amount. Not even to the nursing, but I have mentioned that there have been, has been a recruitment drive since then, in fact, sometime in November. So, we try to reduce these figures.
So, just to follow up on that, though, you clearly identified the problem in terms of shortage. And therefore, the recruitment drive within this particular area is to avoid having these shortages within a nursing at this level. Is that right?
The recruitment drive is actually trying to stay in the nursing bedroom within as the emergencies. And in fact, I put this information into these conducted back in November 2019, and the only thing that is now being followed. And a lot of that, as well, the city pattern has been mitigated substantially by two bank nurses, which are staff nurses, within the cabin for these posts. So, I really would need to meet with this department, but I haven't seen this, because I've gone down to see them, but I haven't had time to look at. The areas in the land are in the whole work and work there, you know, in the department.
Mr. Speaker, I can just ask one last supplementary. As much as I really am grateful for the answer that I've had from the Honourable Minister, one thing I is not clear. It seems that in Devolta, the policy is at the moment to have junior doctors who are known as FHOs in the UK, from what I understand, remaining without a consultant side by side, meaning that all the responsibility is lying on the A&E doctors without any GMC protection if anything goes wrong. And yes, of course, they're extremely efficient, but the point is that sustainable and for how long? Because of the burnout factor and the fact that they are not supposed to be taking on all the senior decision making on their shoulders, and is this the policy going forward of the government as it stands?
I think that these doctors do as far as the limit allows, as far as the professionalism allows. I cannot see, you know, with their training, stabilizing patients if it's a very acute case, you know, that then a patient can be with the course of action, and course of treatment can be established. So, and the only way you said working day without DMC registration, I would assume that all doctors are DMC rated regardless of the level.
I didn't say overstation, I said protection. It's a very different thing. Meaning that if they take decisions beyond their remit and they're not senior doctors and they're taking a direction that they're not licensed to take effectively because they're not on the specialism scale, and on the seniority scale, they would lose their GMC protection. It's not about registration. I know they're all registered. That's the whole risk.
The speaker, they work with the only thing they're using people. They have people working there who are not qualified to work
in that position, and although that was representative, I have represented qualified vision. Of course, the qualified vision, I mean, I'm mostly vision, because I think that many people have two medical systems, so they know exactly how to. The most important thing that you actually need to work is to stay like a patient. So the patient comes in who has suffered stroke, late cataract, or whatever. That is their job. Stay there and for them to move on to ICU, or whatever they need to do, take the patient away, to be referred out in the world, or whatever. So their first line of defense is to stay like a patient. So the global emergency to progress. You know, in any way that we have people there fighting the front line. We don't know how to hold the rifle. I think it's not really a way that they're perfectly qualified to deal with the aspects of their profession we deal with there. And if they feel that they're not happy with some vision, there are mechanisms by which they can call that people will be able to come to an activity if necessary.
Next question, please.
Question number 37, the number is 2D half an hour.
Does MEDOC and or any other care agency collaborate with the VHA to synergize contractual progression for care workers after their initial 12-week contract?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Speaker, I am not aware of any such collaboration.
Mr. Speaker, the reason I ask this is because I've had several constituents come to me feeling very discouraged that they're given a 12-week program through MEDOC or a care agency with much confirmation that after the 12 weeks, many promises that they will be taken on with the DHA. So really genuinely, I'd like to ask the Minister, what would I say to constituents who have been told that after 12 weeks they're going to be given a contract with the VHA and then sort of fall off a cliff and don't know where to go?
I think I don't know that's no way to take it on. We're told the honorable lady is mentioned, but I'm not aware. I'm pretty sure this is not promising people for had a 12 week stint in MEDOC, which is a private company, but then they have their doors open to come and join us at the VHA. I don't know where this lady comes from. I mean, the only lady would like to enlighten me, I will endeavor to find out, but that's not, you know, I can't see that is, it doesn't make sense to me.
Next question.
Question number 41, the Honourable DJ Rossini.
Can the Minister for Financial Services advise in progress with regard to the entry into new tax treaties?
Also, the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, I congratulate the Honourable Member on his evergreening of our manifesto.
Mr. Speaker, the government has put forward the private sector is keen to enter into new tax treaties with other countries following the agreement of Spain on fiscal matters and the PCA of the United Kingdom. We are engaging with the Finance and the Council, who has set up a specific subcommittee to support our proposed work, and we have also engaged professionals experienced in the field to assist us. However, I do not intend to name the countries we are considering publicly to avoid any unintended consequences that are necessarily publicity at no stage to cause. I will be happy to discuss these with the honourable member behind the speaker's chair.
Speaker, the answer is absolutely right. I've had a bit of an audit of the promises and commitments. In relation to the last point, is he aware that, you talked about a subcommittee, and I think the subcommittee is called the Double Taxation Treaty. The Double Taxation Treaty Committee. And it's chaired by Mr. Nick. Are you aware of any of that has been sent out to the very professional bodies in order to obtain that consultation? And if you is not coming at least without going to the detail of it, you mentioned the sensitivity in relation to this issue, whether the way that it's been put to the members of the profession and the various stakeholders represents the government's views, and I think if you could at least say that
that that's a goal that I not necessarily understand what the Honourable Member has said.
Mr. Speaker, we discussed this to some time with the Parliamentary Council, and after the election, we engaged formally with them and asked them that we wanted to extend the consultation to their membership to get a full picture as to what it is that the private sector believes we should be doing in looking at DPAs. There is no point in the government executing DPAs with countries which have no use for the private sector. So this is what we are trying to attract. And consequently, we invited the Parliamentary Council to engage fully with us. They offered to set up a subcommittee to do it specifically of this work, which they did immediately. We discussed it at last week's Parliamentary Council meeting, after which email that the old member referred to was sent out. I am aware of the contents of that email, and we do anticipate having a full and detailed engagement with the private sector on the jurisdictions that we should be thinking about and why.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If the Honourable Member is going to question me, if the Honourable Member is telling the House that there will be review that through the way of contents that we didn't make up money, can you at least confirm that it would accord with the government's thinking in relation to its approach in relation to the entry into a new set of public affairs and
Mr. Speaker, from memory, because I glanced through it when I was sent it, I believe it does, but I wouldn't expect to be held by an email sent out by a subcommittee of Parliament on behalf of the private sector as reflecting government policy to be before further giving a given that to go through the government's own duty.
Hi, Mr. Speaker. Does he have an expectation as to when a further public affairs treaty will be entered into, or is it impossible for him at this stage to give an indication?
Mr. Speaker, the work will commence with a strategy yet to be agreed, which will then entail some serious work and engaging the different countries that may be identified. So it would be absolutely impossible for me to give any degree of a timeline. What I can say is that I still expect our own strategy to be formulated within the next 2 months.
Okay, so this is the final question, but this is really the final question, Mr. Speaker. The Mike Wells and Mr. Keegan have suggested there whether he is aware that we can give an indication as to when the meeting to vote for the public association seems to be going to be made effective.
But the Honourable Chief Minister has advised that he expects this to be effective end of Q2 2021. Effective. Question number 39, the Honourable Dean Davidson.
Can the Minister for Financial Services state when the bill to amend the bill of exchange in connection with the image presentation will be published?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Mr. Speaker, I anticipate this will be published in the coming months. By which the bill would have been published prior to the Christmas break, but other priorities such as the significant legislative reform programme and budget work, of course, are quite low. Meanwhile, the banks and the bills have been participating in the check delivery process with no adverse impact, and we are in contact with them to ensure they are not negatively impacted by the delay.
The Honourable the Minister says that banks have already been participating in the tech imaging process, as you said, and is that possible without any logistical backup? Would be my first question. And is there anything given the orders I've carried out in relation to the Minister's manifesto that says that the government, the city, and our government promised that we will publish the bill within a month of the election? Is there a specific commitment in that regard
and explain why that's not been able to come to fruition in that time period. But was there anything in that? Why the intention originally was to do in that specific time frame?
The time frame was to be ready to go in September, and we then decided to go so far due to the NRP and the rest of the financial services act. And then, of course, Brexit dates continue to change, and our readiness for that was due to be more particular than this. And that's why we're doing a strike live, and now the draft legislation is being written up to be consistent with the new financial services act, which is, of course, it will be. My understanding is that the banks can continue with the second of the process. And they continue to do so, and we know that on this very important.
Question number 14, the Honourable Dean Davison.
Can the Minister for Financial Services advise whether there has been any progress in attaching further banks to the water?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Mr. Speaker, I and the Business of Gibraltar Finance continue to target new banks and entrants. And you will be aware that most potential progress is in the area of digital banking or fintech, rather than the traditional banking model which continues to consolidate and is generally averse to expansion into smaller jurisdictions. Hence, fintech banks are the sector we are successfully targeting, and the Honourable Member may be aware that we currently have two such firms having been approved in principle by the regulator and going through the final stages of their licensing process. We have also, of course, prepared the pending completion of the Risk Bank
So, with the clarification, Mr. Speaker, when it says we have two parties which are now close to the license, are those in relation to the fintech bank area specifically?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the final answer, fintech bank is expected to be specifically targeted, and none of them will be aware. So the final two such firms have been approved in principle.
Next question. Question number 14, the Honourable D. Davison. Question number 41, the Honourable Ms. M. B. Hassan Nawaz.
An IT flaw within the government law website was discovered in January, and this was reported by Gibraltar's media agency as well as in a few international publications. Has an independent security audit been carried out since this vulnerability was discovered to determine if either vulnerability exists?
I think the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Speaker, I'll answer this question today with question number 42. Question number 42, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Nawaz.
When was the last independent IT security audit of the Gibraltar government undertaken, and how regularly are these audits carried out?
Okay, the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Speaker, the last independent IT security audit requested by AT&T was carried out in 2019. An IT security audit is usually performed when a significant change or upgrade to the government network and all its software applications is undertaken. The security flaw reported in the media in January this year was a vulnerability in the Gibraltar Laws website, which has since been upgraded to a new version. The old Gibraltar Laws website was running on an outdated CMS, which is a content management system framework, which has exposed a series of vulnerabilities. The new website is running on a new framework, which is kept up to date and continuously patched to ensure that the site is safe from the known vulnerability.
Mr. Speaker, most IT security organizations recommend audits twice a year, not just as the Minister described when there are new software packages or versions. So they recommend as a minimum twice a year. Some organizations, governmental organizations, do it monthly or quarterly. So is the government going to commit to audits within frequency, or are they going to continue to simply do them when a new package of software or hardware even hits their systems? and if it did, does it have the resources to make such a commitment if they were interested in hosting biannual audits?
The people didn't suggest that the audits are carried out annually. Audits are carried out as and when required, which could be very much more than twice a year. So it's not that we're saying that they are annual, or that it's right that they're annual. What we're saying is that these audits are carried out very significant change of upgrade to the government network under a set of applications and undertaking, which could be more frequent than that. In terms of whenever an audit is requested, this is on the advice of ITRD. And consequently, I would expect that they don't do that as well, and they tell us when they thought that work to be undertaken.
Mr. Speaker, I was trying to explain, I don't know if I explained myself well, that it was more about, from my understanding, that as a minimum, whether or not there were upgrades or not, they were usually carried out as a minimum of twice a year. And where the government would impose it, but or am I right in understanding that the Honourable Gentleman says that they take their lead from ITLG, which is also a perfectly understandable and appropriate?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the answer is well ready, what would put you in mind, but I think you understood from my answer that we did once a year, that's not the case. What I'm saying is that these are done whenever ITLG believe them to be necessary. We do the professionals that I rely on, and certainly not my people being employed.
Next question.
Question number 50, and the question was the Honourable DJ Lafini.
Can the Minister for Tourism provide the same details of set out in Table 1.01 of the Hotel Occupancy Survey for the year 2019?
I am for the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested by the Honourable Member will be published in the annual Hotel Occupancy Survey, which will be tabled at Parliament once the survey is complete. This information is published only on an annual basis in the survey.
I asked some of the questions in the last meeting of the House in December. There are also other questions arising from the various tourism reports, and I think the Honourable Member and the Minister for the Port also obliged in providing me with the updated figures. And the reason why I ask is because, as you will know, Table 1.1 from last year's hotel occupancy survey takes us to 2018. Given that we are now 2019 has completed, I thought the Honourable Member would be helpful enough to be able to provide me with that information in advance of the publication of the survey. Is there any particular reason as to why he was reticent to provide this information now? If I would have thought we would have had the figures available to him, and he doesn't have the figures available to him now, whether he may reconsider and provide me with the information before the hotel occupancy survey is in fact public.
Mr. Speaker, this survey is normally tabled for Parliament around budget time. So, when you look at the annual members for 2 years, or 22 days into the new year, and this information is provided by the hotel. I don't know whether it has been actually provided the complete information for the whole of 2019. I don't really have any problem in providing the only one that would be with the specific lifeline of that
action. Question number 51, the Honourable Ms. T.D. Hassan-Nahon.
The online procurement of business licenses has not been functional for around a year. The government explained the reason for this and when the online procurement of licenses will resume.
I for the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Mr. Speaker. There was a break in communication between the WorldPay application and the OSD database. Scanning is currently working on a solution with a higher level of automation, which will deliver increased efficiency when it is rolled out.
Mr. Speaker, to follow up with my question, my query applies also to renewals. The fact of the matter is businesses report that if you multiply an hour, which is what it takes to renew licenses, by the amount of businesses that there are, the annual cost of not having an online service actually costs hundreds of thousands of pounds at least. And obviously, companies report that the reduction of red tape is the key to run businesses efficiently. So, considering that the government has been promising a one-step step from 3 elections ago, can the government just tell us genuinely when exactly they expect to roll this out realistically?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady loves to conflate issues and dramatize their position. I suppose that with every business in Gibraltar, that has got to do a renewal, were to quantify what it costs to go and do a renewal, as they always have in the past, versus doing it online, as we have been trying to ensure that they are able to do, with the first government to speak to them, so that they will do. I think if we've added all that cost today, it might be £100,000. It might not. But for each business, it might just be a few pounds, if they're trying to avoid them having to pay by trying to bring about, not just in relation to business, licensing, the new system that the other government is about to roll out, but indeed across the government all the mechanisms that they're trying to roll out. So, Mr. Speaker, we're in the process of trying to do this. Honourable members, including her, are up to accusing of spending money. Part of the money that they're accusing of spending is in trying to achieve that which we have promised to do and are keen to do and are in the process of doing. And as soon as we are able to, we shall be announcing that we have achieved that particular rolling manifesto commitment. And of course, Mr. Speaker, we want to do it as soon as it is possible to do, but these things also lead to vulnerabilities. If we set something up and there is a security vulnerability, they come here and ask us why it is that we could be hacked, and if we don't do it because we're trying to ensure that we do it in a way that we're not hacked, they come here and ask us why it is taking so long. I fully appreciate that is the role of a lonely executive member of Parliament, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, met that lonely. Almost 6,000 people voted for me and gave us a good mandate to show that there is a need for something different to what already exists today. So I don't feel very lonely at all. I think that despite the President's very eloquent and sophisticated answer and spin, he still has not answered us how, after almost, it's going to be 10 years, we still haven't seen these Chinese promises of one-stop shops, and as time goes by, yes, we can always hop back to yesteryear that things are not done, but we all know that things have moved on. People work online, the world is moving faster, technology is key, and we need it on tap, and the Chief Minister knows that very well, because when he announces things that need to come into shape, then he always reminds us how important these priorities are. So in the same way, we also want to understand why this priority has not actually materialized after almost 10 years, and talking about the past and how we used to do things in those days, I don't think will alleviate any business of today wanting to move on with their business. And we still don't have an answer. Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister provide us with an answer?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to have a lady for evidencing a sigh of exaggeration. The great news was in December 2011. We are now in January 2020. That is exactly 8 years and 1 month later, not 10. There's a big difference between a decade and 8 years. And that is the sort of exaggeration which demeans the question of accuracy, which then, of course, means we can have to challenge her. Because, for example, she might say that she's not ready because she's got 6,000 votes, or she had 4,000 votes last time, but she's still on her own in this race. And that is the reality of the result of the last election, with a he and I like it or not.
We're just going to check the second thing. We're going to check whether it's not simply just 91 that is missing. I understand that the questions that follow 91 will not be asked this evening. So we can do, if you wish, question 91 and don't know.
I think that we can answer.
The government has not made a decision to forward details on costs and programs in relation to the Mount project, as this is still at a very early stage. Once relevant investigations are completed and designs and permits awarded, we will be in a position to provide such details.
Mr. Speaker, what are the investigations which the Honourable Deputy Minister has described as well?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the initial phase of the project involves the clearing of vegetation. That will allow the people who are doing it to determine the condition of the different terraces, the paths, the walls, etc. And that will allow a further investigation to take place. We cannot investigate any further because things are covered by overgrown vegetation. That is what's happening at the moment. The vegetation is being cleared, that is the first step of the project. And the other one may also be aware in terms of the finances, which is the question, that there is £200,000 in the revenue that we have spent expenditure, which is being simply set aside for this kind of work.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Deputy Minister assure House that the stringent heritage considerations will apply in relation to this particular project? And I was just sort of widening the question between the not only building but also the environment and the plants and the trees, which are of certain environmental heritage value as well.
Mr. Speaker, yes, in fact, before the work started, the Heritage Trust, the Environmental Safety Group, and the own first have all taken on site to get a better understanding of what it was that is going to happen. They've also been on site again since the work has commenced. And obviously, whatever is done there, we will also go, as it has to under the Town Plan Act, to the Development and Planning Commission eventually, and there will be a wider discussion and debate on the proposal.
Mr. Speaker, does the Honourable Member have an idea as to when the whole project is going to be completed? The Honourable Member wants to know that his party's in the election and the manifesto have very good ambitious plans in relation to that area. Can you give us any indication as to when he thinks it's going to be completed? Will it be during the course of this term of office, or is the Honourable Member looking at a longer period now?
It's not possible to give that indication at this stage simply because of what I said in the answer to the question, which is that once we are able to investigate in detail and determine the work that remains to be done, we'll then be able to go up and phase it with time scales for it to take. So the moment is the preparatory work to allow investigation to take place on the site.
And in relation to the group to that initiative, the factory work stage, do you have an indication of the way in that is likely to be completed?
I can't say at this stage, and I don't want to have clearing vegetation, there's a relative tender release for that, and the contractor is on site. The work will be started after the New Year break.
We've come back now to question number 85, and the question is the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Can I just ask you, on a point of order, Mr. Speaker, clearly the government presumably knows the order to take certain questions, and indeed the clerk knows because he's directing the orchestra or jumping up and down. It would be helpful to pass that information to the members of the because clearly for our own organisation or business, we're all here, and of course we are going to be here, but it would be helpful to have that. We're all trying to make sure the house works better, and I hope that's fair. But if this information is available, and it may be available only recently to the government, so it should be passed on to the members of the government.
There has been, the other one has made aware there has been an admin error. That is the reason. There's no other intent or anything.
Speaker, I wasn't talking about admin error in relation to, for example, what happened in 91, but certainly I haven't been here long since my reincarnation. But it's last time as well, in December, there was an element of backwards and forward. And that's okay. But it would be helpful for us to know that that is what's going to happen at different times.
The figure I can do the system,
that is what's going to happen. In the sense that the reason that we backward and forward is that we don't try and assist honourable members as soon as factors and questions are ready for answer, they are sent to the House, usually in groups relating to ministry. And we try and do that so that the House can organise the order paper. That doesn't mean that the order paper, which gives a number, is the order that is going to be followed. So, for example, the Honourable Minister is not here today, but his questions were completed, they were sent to the House, they were taken the order paper, but he was essentially not here, and he was completely taken the attitude of saying he's not here, therefore you can have a written copy of his answer, or you can choose to ask at the next question time under the existing rules. Instead, because we expect that he will be able to be here and answer orally, we skip in order to enable other members to do the oral asking of questions and therefore also supplementaries. So, the figure where we are able to follow the order paper because it's never been doing this, where we're not able to, we do not. That has always been the way in which I have seen questions handled in this House. If honourable members tell us that they may not be available one day, but they may be available another, in time, then we will try to make arrangements to assist them so that they can be here. If they tell us on the day, then it's sometimes very difficult to do that because other ministers have other responsibilities. Speaker, I'm not sure if the honourable member is going to say, I'm not objecting by any means to the jumping around because of the availability. What I'm saying is that if honourable members have organised, know in advance that that is going to happen, then they should pass that information on. So if the honourable members opposite aren't only just told that one of the ministers is unavailable 10 minutes earlier, they don't really understand, of course. But if they know a couple of days before, and that information has been passed on to the staff, it could also be passed on to the opposition, so we can, you know, we're all members of the same house, and we should know what the actual business is going to be in what order. That's what I'm saying. Because that would require a level of detail that I think would start to interfere with government's ability to plan in the future. And the other thing is that it's normal. Look, it's normal when we were elected and we changed the way that the House dealt with business, because honourable members will know that before there was no indication of anything. I mean, honourable members will know that we were not even told the date of the budget. And once the period for a bill to be taken was up, we had to be ready to take a budget. And so we are trying, wherever possible, to give honourable members as much information as possible so that they can be here when they're questions are going to be dealt with, and they can be off doing their private business and pursuing their money making activities, which they're perfectly entitled to do, when they don't have to be here. But I assume that they do want to be here when the House is in session unless they cannot be. Unless the government is telling us that we want to know if those who are going to be here to ask questions only to some ministers, and those who are not going to be here, they're not going to bother telling us. They know that I endeavour, and I have told them that I'm going to try and fix it, that I'm going to endeavour to answer my questions on Thursday at 3 p.m. They know that traditionally the House deals with questions on the basis of the manner in which people have been elected, etc., that is the way in which questions are answered. And they now know also that we're trying to help everyone, them and the House, by allowing the questions to reach the House as soon as they are completed, so that the numbers can be put on the order paper as soon as possible. So I think I can tell them more than that, but perhaps the Select Committee will be able to work together to avoid what both sides might see as the ways of question time is not working as we might all wish. For example, today, 2 hours of 36 questions, I think it's hardly any time for either side. speaker. The Honourable Member doesn't have to tell me about how badly things were done in the past, because he may find that he and I agree. If it is true that he believes in parliamentary reform in a serious way, that he will find in me and the members on this side of the House, people who are committed to engaging in that process. We can talk about how things didn't work in the past under governments of different political ideologies, and that there could be improvements, and we will both share that view. All I am making, and we are at risk of the Chief Minister killing a very minor procedural point that I was making to try to assist all the members of the panel, and it's creating a mountain out of a molehill. I do not believe that it can be possible that government business is going to be interfered with by simply telling the members on this side of the House in what order questions are going to be taken, because the government is organising its business. They've already organised its business in no particular way. And all they're doing is then taking questions in the order that the government is dictating in accordance with the government business it has organised. So I don't think it's too much to ask for. You simply ask for information. I'm not asking to negotiate the agenda with the Honourable Member. I'm asking that once he decides as leader of the House what the agenda is going to be, we can talk on the information.
I think it seems to me that there is nothing which is a minor procedural issue with the opposition, because they have to make the point during question time. I don't know whether this is a matter of a point of order, and I'm very grateful that you're allowing us the latitude to deal with this in this way. But he does it on the basis of he was a great reformer, and he is asking for something that is eminently reasonable. And that's why he knows that I'm going to get up to make the political points that I'm making, because I'm not going to let him get away with making political points as if he were not a speaker. This is the political equivalent of throwing the stone and hiding the hand. So I know that he agrees with how badly things were done in the past, and not just by the GOC administration. I know in particular how badly you think things were done in the past by the GOC administration, because the other party in 2 general elections against them saying that we will do things completely differently to the way that they were doing it. And he and I, I think, will be able to agree in the Select Committee, when we do negotiate, our questions should be taken, a different way of doing things, Mr. Speaker, which will give everybody the certainty of knowing when they have to be here, rather than when they simply might have to endure the process of questioning in order to be around to ask the questions when they come up. But Mr. Speaker, if you know that you're the best in the world, unfortunately, we suffer differences of timetable, and I don't want ever to inform the House that we're going to do something and then not be able to do it, because we're not going to accuse or of playing with the House timetable. But I think together we'll be able to agree a better way of doing this in the Select Committee. So, as usual, Mr. Speaker, I think he and I will find that we are violently agreeing that things need to change, and we are probably going to be very violently agreeing about what they should change to. But look, I guess that's just the nature of the country through the politics that we've fallen into.
Next question, please. Question number 85, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, service to question 230 of 2019. Can you then advise who the landlord is, and then explain to the corporate entity, of the penalties to which Her Majesty's government is devoted? Office of Criminal Prosecution and Litigation will be relocated to the NatWest Tower 664, 57, 63, Rangel Road, Gibraltar.
I will be over the Ministers of Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 86.
Question number 86, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the length of lease, by the floor space and annual rent subsequent to the first year? When would the lease signed by whom, on behalf of the devolved government, or the premises to which the national government is devolved to office of criminal prosecution litigation will be relocated to Nellis House, 6664, 57/63, Rangel Road, Gibraltar?
I have to the Honourable Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, the landlord is Good Hope Limited. The beneficial owners are the Peralta family, the Sam family, the Libby family, and the Provostolis family, who were respective holding companies. The lease for a period of 12 years. The total area of floor space is 3,932 square feet. The annual rent is £123,858 for the first 3 years. Rent increases are dealt with under clause 1D. The Chief Secretary signed the lease on the 19th of December 2019. I can inform the Honourable Member later.
Just a clarification, the 3,000 square feet is still in relation of the street section.
Yes, it is, Mr. Speaker.
Can I ask, how did the possibility of the rental of these premises arise? Who are these people? But I can't remember exactly when it was, and it's obvious that I made a diary note to the fact that you might have raised it with me. And following that conversation with the Chief Minister, what happened next? The speaker told him I was not averse to what he was telling me, and that he could go off and wait to understand space and whether it would fit all the people's in the Office of Public Prosecution, which is what he was very concerned about, and with the Director of Private Prosecution of Public Prosecution, that's what they went off to do. Did the Chief Minister know who the Attorney General and DPP negotiated with? No, Mr. Speaker, because I wasn't there. Does the government have no other available space for the Attorney General? It has not his existing chambers not been refurbished. What is the business case for hiring extra office space in the private sector? I answered this question already at the time of the last meeting. The last 6 months have not passed. I don't know whether Robert Lennon wants to repeat what I said then, or whether he'd rather just leave it there. May I ask the Minister, was there a business case presented to her in order for the AG to hire premises outside the existing government rental stock? And if so, by whom?
Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, I wasn't the Minister with responsibility for justice at the time that this was negotiated. In fact, have had absolutely no involvement in the negotiation of the lease, and given that this has been negotiated by the Attorney General and by the Director of Public Prosecution, I have absolute trust that they have exercised due diligence and negotiated this in good faith. As a fellow information officer, when this question was last asked last month, I did an exercise with Land Property Services Limited, and they immediately gave me at least 30 other commercial rents where the rent price per square foot was much more expensive than this one. So I hope that that's it.
Question number 87, the Honourable Ms. Denise Fannin.
What are the government's plans to celebrate International Women's Day 2020?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, International Women's Day was first celebrated by this government in March 2012, and this year will be no exception. We have identified how we would like to celebrate it in 2020 and are already making plans with our stakeholders. We will make a decent announcement about the celebration once our plans have been confirmed. I will be happy to discuss them with the Honourable Lady, who can be aware of our plans and participate in, and I can know who always receives an invitation to my event.
Question number 88, the Honourable Ms. M.D. has announced.
When will the results of the gender pay gap survey of 2018 be made public?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, the data is being analysed and will be published in Finland.
Question number 89, the Honourable Minister for Justice,
when will the Pride March take place this year, and is an organisation plan for the event underway?
I the Honourable Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, June is regarded as Pride Month, and the Department of Equality is planning how this will once again be marked. Organisation is already well underway. I have no doubt that it will be as much a success as everything that the Department of Equality invests in. Mr. Speaker, I have a few representations from interested parties asking whether a contract for an organised event would be going out to tender, or would it just simply be taken on by the Ministry itself. Would the Honourable Member be able to clarify, because I have been asked various times about this one. Mr. Speaker, when the Department of Equality marks any event, we always do it ourselves, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Department of Equality for their dedication to these events with meticulous planning and the very successful execution.
Question number 19, the Honourable Ms. M.D. has announced.
According to the GSRC Manifesto of 2019, I quote, in Gibraltar under the Equal Opportunities Act, sexual orientation is still not a protected category with regard to the provision of goods and services. It cannot be acceptable for a business to refuse service due to the sexual orientation of the customer, but currently no law prevents this. Unquote. When will this be corrected and the Equal Opportunities Act amended?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, the process to eliminate this discrimination has already commenced immediately upon our re-election, and we in the GSRC Liberals are the only ones to pledge to do so. Mr. Speaker, I thank the Honourable Lady for her answers, but I don't think I heard an answer as to when will this be corrected? Any idea of when this act will be amended? Because the inspection has already been given, I'm aware that the legal drafting team are working on it, so certainly have an instruction from me to complete the different discussion.
I believe that the Honourable Minister now has a response or reply to the Honourable Member.
Mr. Speaker has so far as the Honourable Member wanted via WhatsApp, which I am just guessing has to do with the cancellation that he was asking for, but I said that I didn't know what had happened since I answered the question to today, and the answer is that cancellations were initiated due to safety protocols as a result of some fat power failure, and the removal of all users from inside the plane area when the power came down, came back, they were restarted. So it wasn't actually a cancellation of an allocation, but a precaution for the safety of users. So they were told to come out, and then they were told to come in, and this happened in the second.
Right, Mr. Speaker. So, I know I'm going to move the House to adjourn until tomorrow at 3 p.m., Thursday at 3 p.m., and on the third Thursday of the month, which is when I intend to take a few things to question time. So, I mean, I've been able to be very successful for 6 and a bit of the 8 years of being government when the President hasn't interfered. And I will, of course, advise any members of the opposition who wish to take on the mantle of leading the opposition and asking questions of the current leader of the House to be here tomorrow at 6. That might help us to work out what might happen on the 31st, Mr. Speaker. I'm moving the House now again to 3 o'clock tomorrow.
I now propose a question, which is that this House
deny the
motion Thursday 23rd, adjourning at 3 p.m. I now put the question, which is that this House now adjourn to Thursday 27th of adjourn at 3 p.m. Those in favour, those against, this House now adjourn to Thursday 27th of January at 3 p.m.